Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello and welcome to Signal of Doom, episode 106. I'm Dave, I'm here with the main man, Stu. Stu, how are you?
I'm good, Dave. How have you been this week?
Well, other than losing my phone and still searching for it.
Oh, and just whinging about
and
it.
And just not happy.
Constantly whinging.
Just not happy with that. Like, dude, you just mentioned before the show, IG-88. I need him on this fucking phone mission.
What?
That's what I need. He's the ultimate bounty hunter.
Talk about the most overkill you can possibly have.
A death droid, one of my favourites. And before we even get into the news, Stu just coughed this news up as just a sort of like addendum. What did you say Taika Waititi's voicing IG-88? Just kick straight into the news.
I mean, it looks, put it this way, with The Mandalorian, Jon Favreau tweeted a picture of Taika Waititi clearly doing voice acting.
Right.
And he's staring at a screen with IG-88 on.
I'm going to say this.
So it looks like he's watching the film with IG-88 trying to voice it. And
I can't stand the idea. I love it. Waititi, but his voice for
the amount of people that said his voice will not fit Korg at all. It's stupid. Don't do it.
It's comedic is what it is.
And then all of a sudden we watch Korg and we love it and we can't think of anything else that would fit it better.
I can think of things that would fit it better, but it was comedic. I don't want a comedic IG-88. I mean, comedic, yes, he was very good as Korg. I mean, but that New Zealand accent applied to IG-88, who should have a robotic voice when he talks.
Who's to say it won't be robotic?
I just don't look.
I don't know. I think you're assuming a lot of stuff about this,
no,
and
I think
you're going to be dead wrong.
I know his voice. It's a comedic voice.
Oh, really? You know his voice?
Heavy New Zealand accent. We saw how that worked with the Stormtroopers. I couldn't stand it when they changed the Stormtroopers and Jango Fett's voice to the, you know, the New Zealand accent. I thought that was terrible.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I'm not, dude, I'm far from alone in saying that about the Stormtroopers all getting changed to.
Yeah, but those people
was.
Are. They're douches, let's be honest. They're people who just get on the internet and whinge about the most mundane things.
There was plenty of people.
This is the most stupid thing to have a strong opinion on.
When the prequels came out.
Either way, it's ridiculous.
No, it's not.
It is. It's absolutely ridiculous.
When the prequels came out, a lot of people couldn't stand they changed the Stormtroopers' voices to the Kiwi.
I think that was the last on the list of complaints about the prequels.
I'm telling you, it was in the top.
This is people that are nitpicking about the most stupid things.
It was just silly.
If you're listening to them, you're as big an idiot as they are.
That's what happens.
If you sit there listening to these guys and believing everything they say, that is stupid. That is absolutely ridiculous.
You see, and people are entitled to have an opinion. And I don't like they revoice the Stormtroopers' voices for the Kiwi just because of the Jango Fett connection.
You're a fan of the weather?
Look up.
Was the weather appropriate?
Okay, we've got people.
Let's find other mundane details. The colour of the grass on Taboo.
We've got people who listen to the show who are big Star Wars fans. Let me know what you think. That was one of the top 20 complaints about the prequels. I mean, that's a common complaint.
Was it number 20?
It was.
Was it right at the very bottom of that list where they struggled to fill in the top 15?
The younger generation, a lot of whom grew up with the prequels, and
I did grow up with the prequels. They're not good.
Had a different opinion, yeah. But like that's quite a common complaint about the prequels, that they changed the Stormtroopers' voices.
Yeah,
it is.
That doesn't make it valid.
No, I think it's valid. I thought it was stupid. Like, but more importantly, though, Taika Waititi, great director. Don't get me wrong, great director. I'm sure will do a fantastic job. I just felt from Korg it was a very comedic take. That's all I'm saying.
And it was a comedic role. That's how comedy works. You don't have to be comedic in every role you do.
I don't want to have a New Zealand, like, thick New Zealand accent. I think that would be stupid. Like, honestly, he deserves, like, almost a.
Have you ever heard him do a different accent? Have you ever
heard him speak in interviews?
In his natural accent, in his normal speaking voice.
He's got a heavy New Zealand accent.
He's from New Zealand. That's his natural accent.
Okay.
Have you ever heard him do an accent?
I've only heard him do his voice.
All of a sudden, your argument's looking like fucking shit.
Why?
Margot Robbie. Heavy Australian accent. You ever seen her in a movie?
But I've only
Have you ever seen her in a movie?
I've only seen Taika Waititi do New Zealand accents in anything he's
You're right. Voice. If you haven't seen it, it doesn't exist. Is that what you're trying to claim?
I will go on
Is
record.
Is that actually what you're trying to claim?
I will go on record as saying I think it's stupid. Like, get a professional voice actor. Don't
he is a professional. That's what he does. He is a professional voice actor.
He's a director. That's his main career. He's a director. That's his bread and butter. His voice acting career is insignificant compared to his directing career. Was that a fair call?
Not really, no.
Not really. You think Taika Waititi has as big a voice acting career as he does as a director? Really?
No, I don't. I never said it was as big. I said it's not insignificant.
I would say it's insignificant.
Really? You think it's so insignificant you can't even bother including it with it? You can't even mention the idea that he's ever voice acted.
Compared to his directing, it is tiny. He's a famous director who has hit movies, is directing Mandalorian. I mean, if his voice is IG-88... I'll watch it, but I don't like it.
I don't get what mood you're in. You're just nitpicking every little detail blowing up over it.
No, I'm just making a point.
No, you're not. You're blowing up over every little detail. You sat there for half an hour and lectured me on how you lost your own phone.
I'm not lecturing you. I'm just...
You did. You spoke at me for half an hour about you losing a phone and expected me to fix it somehow? I don't know.
I'm not expecting you to fix it, Stu.
And all of a sudden, you're just blowing up over Taika Waititi's voice acting, possibly...
I don't like it at all.
Possibly voice acting IG-88.
I'm allowed to not like it.
You can, but...
Thank you.
What the fuck reasoning was that?
The reasoning is that because you don't agree with me doesn't mean the point's invalid.
The point being invalid is why I'm disagreeing.
You can just agree.
You've got that backwards.
You can just agree to disagree.
Why would I do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Why would I do that?
Well, because I think that would be the more mature thing to do, frankly.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I really do. Let's roll the tape back. You actually think he's got a significant voice acting career.
He's got a voice acting career.
What else has he done if he's got such a significant voice acting career? Like, what's he done?
Do you need to have 1,000 credits to be a voice actor?
Yes, you actually do. Like,
oh, really?
A proper voice actor, a proper professional actor who's not just doing a few roles, does tons of work.
How many would you say you need to have to be a voice actor?
20 plus. To have a significant role. Let me tell you.
There you go. Hollywood, I hope you're listening, Hollywood. Definition from now on is...
No, I'm telling you.
20 plus, you can call yourself a voice actor.
They work for scale.
Anything fewer, your career is insignificant.
No, yes, if you have less than 20 credits as a voice actor, Stu, you're not a particularly...
Oh, that's the rule now, isn't it? Okay.
Well, look at it.
Fewer than 20 doesn't count. Is that what you're saying?
I'm telling
you. Quentin Tarantino has directed 9 films. Fewer than 20, therefore, not a director. Is that what you're saying?
Do you want to know what's different? Voice actors, professional voice actors, who it's their main gig,
do a ton
of work. They work for scale. They do a ton of work. They do stacks and stacks and stacks of episodes. As opposed to a celebrity... who comes and does a few. And you see that these days. They cast big-name actors to do a bit of voice acting, as compared to just someone who comes in and does show after show, like a Clone Wars.
I don't understand what you're arguing, Dave. I honestly don't understand what you're arguing.
I reckon listeners will understand. I don't think it's that hard to understand.
Really?
Yeah, I really don't. I think you've
gone off on a tangent of a tangent of a tangent from something that wasn't a valid point in the first place.
Original point. He has a very insignificant voice acting career.
That's not the original point.
A list of credits, show it to me. Like, seriously, and I'm talking to the listeners.
Made my own argument for me.
No, I'm not at all.
What are you arguing anymore?
Stu is playing opposite game. That's what he likes to do. We'll leave the point.
Little Dave's having a cry.
I'm not having a cry at all, but I'm sticking to my original. Show me what he's done voice acting-wise other than IG-88. Anything? No, nothing. Exactly, nothing. Zero. All right. James Gunn rehired by Disney for Guardians. This was actually surprising news. Pleasing news, but I didn't see this coming, Stu, did you?
Look, we sat on the fence either way when it came to this game. So I'm honestly not surprised when he got fired. I wasn't surprised when he got rehired. I think it's all...
I was surprised by the rehire.
It's all kind of reshuffling of assets.
Yeah, but I was still surprised. I'll be honest, I was surprised by the rehire.
The other thing is, I don't think they expected him to go to Warner's as quickly as he did.
Well, I think that was the most obvious thing in the world.
I don't think they expected him to do it that quickly, though.
Okay.
I think they were expecting him to fight for his job a little harder.
Hmm.
And they'd bargain, drive the price down, all that sort of stuff.
I reckon the price went right back up when he got hired for Suicide Squad.
Well, exactly. And that's part of the reason why they've hired him back. They've hired him back partly just to get him away from the competition.
Yeah, I agree.
He's a massive threat. So you want him on your side.
Agreed. I know. I think it's a smart move. I'm actually... It was one of those weird ones where I was like... To me, that was common sense, but you often don't see it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't have been surprised if Disney hired him down the track. I think that was where I was thinking originally. But to be hired on the very project you're fired by, I was sort of surprised. Now, they're saying it won't be until 2021-22 because it's after Suicide Squad and after the promotional tour and everything else. And Suicide Squad is a fair way off itself. I think it's got a release date, August 6, 2021, and it's apparently a total reboot. Because that news came out like a day before the news of the rehiring. So I think it's kind of interesting. Yeah. And Idris Elba was hired for Deadshot, wasn't he, in Suicide Squad?
Rumoured. I don't think it's been confirmed.
Okay. Kevin Feige assures everyone that Captain Marvel will have an Achilles heel. She will have her kryptonite, because I think some people were saying she was too powerful, blah, blah, blah.
I never got that. I never, like, watching that movie, I never understood that she was too powerful. Like, she was...
Well, not to go, but
had a massive fractured psyche and mentally quite weak in the film, I thought.
True.
Like, physically, yeah, overpowering, but I thought mentally very, like...
Well, the history of her character was always... Like, she was an alcoholic at one point, wasn't she? She was... She's been quite...
Yeah, I mean, the character's almost been completely reborn three or four times, so... Yeah. We kind of get that this is an amalgam of those four characters.
What do you think that will? Do you think it will be an internal psyche thing, or do you think it'll just be like she's, you know, like a version of kryptonite that weakens her, or will it be more?
They're not actually going to have like a magical rock that weakens her. That's way too on the nose.
The equivalent of that, though, like an object or something, or will it be an internal psychological thing? Is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, her power comes from the same place as Wanda's. So,
where's that? Chaos, magic, or something.
The Infinity Stones?
Really?
What do you mean, really? This question right now worries me, Dave. It worries me for several reasons.
Really? No, I'm slightly confused. What, her power comes from the Infinity Stones?
Yeah, it comes from the Space Gem.
I suppose it did power up, didn't it? And so does Wanda's? Because Wanda's in the movies is different from the comics, where she's like
chaos. Well, hers came from the Mind Gem, but still Infinity Stone.
Okay. So it's all completely from there, though.
Yeah.
I'm asking. I don't know. You're much more into the details of these things. I get confused with the comic origin as well. I thought it was a blending of the Supreme Intelligence or some power from the Kree as well that gave her the power.
The Kree was doing literally the opposite that entire movie. It was suppressing the powers. That's what that chip was on her neck that kept glowing.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I worry that sometimes you sit through these movies and then you kind of just fall asleep for most of it.
To be honest, I don't remember the reasoning. Hers I do more because we saw more recently. But Scarlet Witch's power source, I never really kind of got what they were doing. Weren't they experimenting on her and her brother at one point, like Hydra?
Yeah, with Loki's scepter, which had the mind gem in it.
So they didn't have any natural powers. They're the product of experimentation, basically.
Yeah, same as Brie Larson's Captain Marvel. She has no power. She's a human pilot.
But she absorbed the power of the gem, basically.
More or less, yeah. When the warp drive exploded.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
She kind of had Kree blood infused in her, and we think that's kind of given her enhanced strength a little bit.
What's the source of her power and Captain Marvel's power in the comics? Like, what's... I thought their power was more sort of from the Kree.
Well, I mean, Mar-Vell was Kree, 100% Kree, and he had the Nega Bands, which gave him all the cosmic-y powers. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much it with him.
Right, okay.
Carol Danvers was standing next to that giant machine when it blew up, filled her with radiation.
Oh, yeah, we saw that. There was a flashback of that in one of the comics we did recently, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's been retold multiple times.
Okay.
But yeah, she basically absorbs a bunch of radiation, similar to like a Bruce Banner.
Okay, all right, but in the movie...
Ends up with, like, super strength and flight.
Okay.
And she just takes on the role, and then, over time, powers have changed depending on who's writing her.
She's got a convoluted history.
Quite a fickle character when it comes to what powers
she has. At one point, being absorbed into Rogue for many years.
Yeah, exactly, and that's where she got the flight from, Rogue's flight came from.
Yeah, where Rogue's flight... Do you think they will do that storyline at some point? I reckon that's a pretty natural story for them to do at some point in the X-Men versus Avengers?
If they ever get there, yeah.
It's a pretty cool story on Rogue's part.
Yeah, I mean, you'd want to do it towards the end...
Of the movie.
Of not just the movie, but the end of, like, a massive phase of them, just so you could get away from the idea that Carol's going to survive no matter what.
Okay.
Yeah. We're at the start of a 7-movie contract. Like, when she walks into Endgame, I'm in no way worried that she's going to die.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
No, exactly.
Whereas if you give me 6 movies and then you have Rogue show up and start absorbing powers, I'm thinking, oh shit, final movie on her contract.
I've got a question.
Sure, she could resign, but at least there's some kind of danger there, maybe.
In the comics, when Rogue absorbed her, and I think I have read the actual comic, when Rogue absorbed her, I thought it was more psychological. And in the animated series, she was in a coma. Carol was in a coma. and like Rogue absorbed her so much that she actually took on the power set of the.
Well, that's what her power is.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, she's actually one of the best evil mutants.
Oh, ever. Yeah, Rogue. Yeah, she can just.
Because if she holds on to you and just kills you.
Yeah.
She takes your memories, she takes your power set, she takes.
And in this one, it was always done as like it was really early on in Rogue's career where she started.
I mean, if you ever watched the show Heroes.
Yeah.
Remember how the villain was like that Psylar guy who just absorbed people's powers by killing them?
Yeah, yeah.
He would cut their heads open and kind of absorb their powers. I mean, Rogue's kind of the good person equivalent of that.
Mm.
Her ability is to kill people and take their power set.
Yeah, if she keeps holding on, that's what she'll do.
Yeah, so I think the way they wrote it was they put Carol in a coma.
Right.
Like, seconds away from death kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which means eventually Rogue will lose those abilities.
Right, yeah.
I think that's kind of the loophole they wrote in. Like, if Carol survives, then it's not going to be permanent, you know? Yeah,
the animated series did it really well. They did a really good episode, considering the time it was done, where they sort of told the story really quite nicely. But what my question was, in the 80s, when it happened, because it happened right at the beginning of the 80s, I believe, the actual issue, was Carol Danvers in a coma for years and years and years, like in the X-Men animated series? Or what was, did you know what was happening with Carol Danvers during that period? Like, you know, but eventually she obviously came back because she was in Marvel Ultimate Alliance and she was in, you know, Brian Reed's book and all that kind of stuff as Ms. Marvel and then was reborn by Kelly Sue DeConnick. But was there a period where Carol Danvers was out of commission completely?
Basically, yeah.
Because Rogue had her powers, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. It's interesting. No, I reckon it'd be an interesting, like, beat in a movie, basically. You know, like.
It's the same kind of way they did when Cap died.
Yes.
In inverted commas, died, got shot in the steps of the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Courthouse.
Yeah.
And he was out of commission for a little while there.
Great story. And Bucky was capped for a while.
Yeah, there were kind of a few people that tried it on and Bucky ended up running with it for the longest.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the same idea. He was out of commission for a while and then eventually they just found a way to write him back in and he's been there ever since.
Okay, cool. Well, I think it's good. Now, this is big news. This was quite shocking news. Ezra Miller is apparently writing the script of Flash in a bid to stay on a star, and he's working with Superstar Comics author Grant Morrison on the script.
Yeah, I think we should premise by saying he's writing a version of the script. They haven't purchased it. It is not the final version at this point.
Oh, no, they've been paid, to do it.
Well, yeah, they've been paid. But if this fails, if the studio reads it and goes...
Don't like it.
Too much, not enough, can't take it, whatever the reasoning, Miller's almost signed his own death warrant.
Well, his deal expires in May. So it's really his last minute stuff. So his Flash contract, his holding deal expires in May. So he needs to get a script in and they need to see whether they like it or not by then.
So they can extend this contract, yeah. I don't know. I think it's good that they've got... like a serious writer next to him.
Grant Morrison, who's done Flash.
Exactly. Flash. I think that's a massive boost.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I mean, one thing about Ezra Miller, and I'm not even his biggest fan. I will say, honestly, he really obviously loves being the Flash. He just hasn't really had the material to shine at all. Like, but, you know, this is a guy who's hungry.
No, I think. And I like the fact that these are two guys who properly understand the characters.
Yeah.
So even if they were to... mash up like a Wally West, mash in even when they went like who's the old school original Flash?
Jay Garrick.
Like they could mash in a couple of characters and they'd know what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's not like a lot of these screenwriters who will read 10 to 15 comics, the you know, most iconic ones they can find in a web search.
Yeah.
Read 10 of them and then go, oh, I got enough.
The only thing they've read is like Christ on Earth is where Flash dies. And they're like, oh,
yeah, God. And they read the biggest sellers that Flash is in. Yeah. That's not even a good version of Flash, you know? Exactly.
Well, Grant Morrison had a short but really good run on Flash with Mark Miller at the time and then wrote Wally West Flash in his JLA for like 42 issues.
Yeah.
And did a good job. Like, and it was good stuff. I mean, I'm, as we all know, a huge Grant Morrison fan. I'm loving... I mean, I'd love to see the script when it actually gets turned in. We'll see what happens. Apparently, a lot of it came down to they want to go brighter. Ezra Miller wanted to do a darker take and, you know, so they're sort of at odds. So, hey, you know, you miss every shot you don't take, you know? Like, so I think it's good that they're actually doing
it. It is a little odd that he wants to go darker. Because, I mean, that's been the overarching criticism of... Yeah. The Snyderverse version of DC.
I know. But that's reportedly, though. We don't know that. I mean, there was a lot of conjecture around this news when it came out. I think it's just interesting that the Grant Morrison's doing a Flash script with Ezra Miller. I mean,
we can only hope that Grant Morrison's kind of got the lighter touch with that script.
Yeah, role. I mean, yeah, Grant Morrison's sort of like, he's all over the map regarding Dark and Light. I mean, I think quirky and he's good with characters. He loves throwing in sort of apocalyptic stuff, but... I mean, he's a very varied writer. He certainly, you know, he just doesn't do dark and grim, but he certainly does darker take on stuff sometimes. Some of his stuff runs darker, like Happy, for example.
I mean, he's certainly got the option to do it. I hope he doesn't. I hope he intentionally writes this with the...
bit lighter.
With the intention of making this a lighter film, a more enjoyable film.
I'll tell you what, Adam the Computer Crouch is seeing Shazam this weekend, a pre-event screening. He got an invitation to, was just showing in his local town, so he's going to report in... After the movie to see what it's like. Pretty cool. Like, that's quite a way out in front of regular release, isn't it?
It's very early. It's like a month
yeah,
and a bit.
Yeah. It was some Fandango thing or something he said. So he's seeing it. He's literally seeing it this weekend.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Literally in his hometown. Now, we had, Stu, two Tarantino fans here big time. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie. I mean, the list goes on. The late Luke Perry's involved. Like, it's a long list of stars attached. And the first teaser trailer just got released like about 24 hours ago.
Yeah, it is a weird teaser trailer.
I like it. I mean, it's going for that kind of like late 60s, like LA vibe. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but we could have established that vibe in about 5 seconds. And sure. I think Tarantino did establish that in the first 5 seconds. The rest of the minute 30 kind of feels like a waste of time. I don't feel like I want to see the film any more or less.
Yeah, it's not the world's greatest trailer.
It's just a minute and a half of 60s references.
Which I think... I did like to see Bruce Lee, though. I'm a Bruce Lee guy. That was great to see Bruce Lee involved in the movie, who apparently, legend says, only lived about a block away from Sharon Tate's house. And there was a list on the internet today of all the different actors who are playing all the different people. Like, someone's playing Roman Polanski, who was her husband, I believe.
Yeah.
Or it was his house where the murders happened. I'm not sure if he was married to her, but certainly knew her. There's a whole list of cast of people. Apparently, the Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt characters are loosely based on Burt Reynolds, and I assume he's stunt person. You know, and sort of all those kind of like melds. I mean, for me, this is so far up my alley, this whole movie. I mean, I'm so excited by like the setting, the locale, and the director. You know what I mean? Like, Tarantino's going to go overboard. We know it.
Oh, yeah. Look, I've been a fan of every one of his films. Yeah. I think he's an absolute talent. But
what did you think of Hateful Eight? Because that was one that I must have, and I haven't made it through. I watched about half of it, and I was kind of like, I love every Tarantino movie, and I just wasn't in the mood for Hateful Eight, but I didn't think it was as compelling as pretty much any of his movies.
That I really like that one. I really
is it worth... That. Does it get, like, sort of... I found it was a slow start, but, I mean, I'm prepared to give it a go. I love every Tarantino movie, so, like, Django Unchained.
Well, I mean, if you love every Tarantino, like...
Up till that movie. Like, I mean, I'm just saying, does it really pick up in, like, the sort of second, third act? Because I found the first act was painfully slow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a Tarantino film. That's how they roll, typically.
Jackie Brown, man. Like, the other day I was talking about Jackie Brown with someone. Like, that's a beautiful movie. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Maybe it was just the setting. Maybe it was my mood at the time because, like, I put movies like... Inglourious Basterds, I think, is a fascinating one. And a lot of people are saying that he might do revisionist history in this movie, like he did with Inglourious Basterds, like sort of change the, you know, maybe kill Manson, but you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it'll depend on how faithfully he sticks to any of these characters. I mean, the fact that he's already changed what is meant to be Burt Reynolds kind of tells you that, yeah, he's going to change a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, but it's not actually Burt Reynolds. Like, they're just saying it was loosely based. Like, some of the characters, like Bruce Lee is, you know, cast as they're doing Bruce Lee. Whereas the characters DiCaprio and Brad Pitt are playing are not real people. You know what I mean?
But if they're based on a particular person who had stories, then and they're intentionally changing the name, then, yeah, they're going to do something like, you know, kill them off early when obviously...
But do you think they'll kill, like, Manson, is what I'm saying? You know, he obviously lived.
You know? If they're definitely going with calling him Manson in the movie, then...
Yeah, they are.
Then no, they're probably not going to kill him in there.
Okay, well, Charlie Manson is... Yeah, he's one of... His role is there, like Sharon Tate. Like, there's someone cast to play Charlie Manson.
Yeah, it's just whether or not that name is used in the film. That's what
it is.
I'm saying.
I'm telling you it is. Like, it's...
Yeah, I know. That's... Okay. You're in a weird mood today, Dave.
No. I'm just saying it.
You're in a very weird mood.
I'm not. I'm just saying it is.
I know. And I said, listen, this wasn't a question. It was a very statement.
Right.
If they are changing their name, they will change the story. If they go with their actual names,
yeah.
they have to kind of go with what happens in truth.
They can't kill
off a character that lived. They can't make character live that
died. That's what I'm saying. Inglourious Basterds, they kill Hitler, which in the theatre.
Yeah, but all the other characters, very different people. They're not based on fact. It was an Elseworlds kind of reality.
Okay, but that's what I'm asking, though. Like, in Inglourious Basterds, he very did revisionist history, and they shot Hitler in the theatre. What I'm saying is, will they shoot Charlie Manson, do you think? Like, will they prevent the tragedy from happening, is what I'm trying to sort of say. Could that
be... No, that's the whole point of the film, isn't it?
You would think so. I mean, Hollywood loves this story because I think it's a story of Hollywood, you know. And he was like a D-lister, Charlie Manson. He wrote like one song with one of the Beach Boys or something. Like he was a hanger on.
Yeah, I mean, if you picked up this script and you wanted to, or let's say you had the IP and you wanted to write a movie on it,
sure.
Why would you change one of the greatest stories they've got?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just
like it's
people are throwing around ideas on the internet, man. A lot of it based because Inglourious Basterds they killed Hitler. So they're thinking that the Tarantino, like that was, I'm explaining.
Yeah, I know. It's just another, like, why does that mean anything? That's
true.
I do not understand a lot of these internet trolls. They just focus in on one fact and go, if this is true, therefore, and they leap to some ridiculous conclusion.
I think part of it is probably that's the very nature of reporting on.
It's a stretch. It's a stretch at best.
News on entertainment that hasn't been released yet. It's like everyone being convinced that Palpatine is going to be in episode 9. There's really no evidence to say that, but it's picked up a lot of groundswell on various sites that are big. But really, they started the rumor. You
that's
know what I mean?
Like that's...
And then they're reporting on the rumor as almost as if it's fated to happen. It's like, you guys actually did start this rumor. There's still no evidence of the guy who played Palpatine on set.
Yeah.
You know, like so.
And part of this whole media cycle at the moment is one news organization makes up news and doesn't say that it's made up.
Sure.
And someone else reports on it as fact because they heard it on a factual show.
Yeah.
And then it just cycles out of control.
What's interesting is, though, sometimes politicians and even entertainment places react to that news. That even makes it even more kind of weird to me.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny. Like, there's sort of dog chasing their own tail kind of thing. Like, it's bizarre. This was good news. Cyborg is officially gone from the DCEU, won't be appearing in the solo movie, Stu, or any further group projects.
I actually don't believe this.
Well, the guy said he's no longer attached. Ray Fawkes, or whatever his name is.
Yeah, I don't think Cyborg is gone. I think that actor is gone.
He's definitely gone.
I reckon gone. Cyborg will be back at some stage.
I mean, I find... You're probably right. I mean, I find DC desperate to make Cyborg a thing. Like...
Because I think Cyborg could be a thing.
Yeah, but he's so shit, though, in, like, everything.
Yeah, but you could say the same of a lot of characters that they did one movie of, and all of a sudden he's the greatest character of all time.
But do you want Cyborg... Like, when Cyborg got in Justice League, he was suddenly in all the books of Justice League. Like, you couldn't get away from Cyborg. And, like, then the movie came out, and he sucked in that.
Yeah, but put it this way. If I said they're making a new RoboCop movie...
Sure.
Are you down on it... Because RoboCop is in it, or just because they're reusing a title, or like RoboCop and Cyborg could be virtually the same thing. They're incredibly similar characters if you write them the same way.
I wouldn't mind a RoboCop. I mean, they remade it a few years ago, not that well, but I wouldn't mind it. I liked the original RoboCop movie 1. I mean, it was heavily satirical and I thought quite cool.
But they could certainly do that same treatment of Cyborg.
Yeah, kind of make him more like Deathlok, for example.
Exactly right, yeah.
That would be a lot more interesting than what they've done with Cyborg every time I see him. Like,
yeah, but all it takes is one director who goes,
true,
I've read the comics and I don't like the character, but I would like a character who can interface with computers. I think that's something that I need for my story to work, so let's write him in there, but let's make him an incredibly sarcastic character, or let's make him...
That would be better than any Cyborg I've ever seen.
Let's make him like a beloved character who we all know and love, who ends up like trapped in this cyborg body.
Yeah.
And that completely changed the origin.
Oh, I like the concept of it. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately what we get stuck with is superstar athlete, bad father, experiment goes awry, he's Cyborg. And it's like, man, like what you just explained sounds a lot more interesting.
I think you're allowed to take those Like, look at what they did to the origin of Captain Marvel. Like, the most recent Marvel film.
Sure.
They completely took apart the idea that Mar-Vell was a, you know, Kree warrior that came to Earth.
Sure.
And that Carol Danvers inherited her powers.
Mm-hmm.
And her name, after following this Kree soldier around, they yeah. completely destroyed that. And I don't think anyone's complaining that it wasn't 100% accurate to the canon.
And I also would say Cyborg's a C-lister, so I think you've got more room with those guys, you know?
Well, yeah, and until the recent run of Cyborg, run single movie,
yeah,
people didn't really know his origin story. No. It's not like a Spider-Man, we all know the origin.
The only people who knew it were Teen Titans fans, like, because that's where Cyborg was big. You know what I mean? Like, he's... But DC tried to make him a thing. They had him through all the comics for fucking 2 or 3 years before that movie. Then the movie came out, and... Like, yeah, I think maybe... I don't want to see a Cyborg... Like, I'm not really stumbling to the cinema to see a Cyborg solo movie. But if they did it really well, and it got good reviews, I would go and see it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm... I just think they need to get away from... I think they need to start again with the character kind of thing. Like you're saying.
Well, they can. I mean, there's nothing stopping them from rewriting a backstory in a film universe, especially.
Sure.
It's harder to do so in the comics.
But do you use... I mean, back in, like, the old days, that was all they ever did. They used to take characters and just go, we like the name, and we'll do our own thing. And it's kind of like... Something Marvel does well, I think, is sort of melding and meshing and coming together with sort of like Iron Man. It's not the exact same story of the origin, but it's very similar. It's the same thematic beats.
No, well, I mean, part of it's the sliding effect, where it used to be like...
Vietnam.
The Vietnam War, and then it became Afghanistan, and it's kind of...
Yeah.
Slid, depending on what time they're
the
in.
But the themes of it, the basic beats are the same, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which that's what I like.
And how many times have they rebooted Spider-Man? In every universe.
Yeah, a lot.
And it's all virtually the same thing. It's young yeah. student,
yeah.
overwhelming sense of kind of the typical good guy themes. Yeah, like, he feels massive amounts of guilt for other people.
Uncle Ben's death.
Gets driven into doing good things in a supersuit after getting bitten by a spider. Like, it's the same story.
And now they can tell it in a fast up like they did in Spider-Verse. They just do the fast jam version of it. To bring it up to speed. He goes, now, story. You know.
Well, I mean, yeah, that was looking at Peter Parker.
Yeah.
When they did Miles Morales in Spider-Verse, they actually tried to subvert your expectations because we knew the origin story, you get bitten by a spider.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of made this big build-up of this spider crawling all over him and all over the cans of paint he was using.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you see the spider, like, dig his fangs in, and it just cuts to Miles, like, looking at it and just slapping it.
Which was good, I thought.
Like, there was this beat of comedy in there, because they could do that.
Mm.
It's such an obvious story now, they can play with it. Cyborg's the opposite. Cyborg's unknown. You could do anything. You could have him being an astronaut, come back from space, rocket ship blows up.
Yeah.
And they find most of his body, they fix it. Like, it's...
Anything would be better than what they've done so far. Anything, pretty much. Like, I find Cyborg's current backstory so underwhelming that it's almost like it's a cipher of a character. And yet there is potential in a computer sort of, like, mesh version of a character, you know. But that's also something...
The other thing for me is you could really fuck around with things and make him a character that we all know about.
Mm.
And just thought he was dead for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could almost make him like a Thomas Wayne kind of character. I wouldn't do Thomas Wayne per se, but...
What do you mean? And what, he's stuck in the internet or something?
Well, no, the idea that a character that we know about has died decades ago.
Yes.
The scientists took his body, froze it, whatever they do, science, MacGuffin-y kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he comes back decades later, you know, like a Winter Soldier kind of reveal.
Again, it would be a lot more interesting than what they've done before. Like, yeah, you're showing some creativity, which, like, I think the character needs. You know?
Because that way you get a reveal, you get an origins, you could get all, like, the major beats that you want.
Dude, anything's better than was a star football player who then got in a car accident and his dad's a crazy scientist and inserted some cybernetic shit and then he became Cyborg, which is the basic story of Cyborg. Like, that's basic.
I mean, we say that, but that's just Tony Stark without his money.
I know, but, like... That's the story of Cyborg. Like,
I still think there's a way to make that work. I don't think that's inherently a bad story.
I just find that all you get with Cyborg is he's the guy, if there's a computer needed, he goes up and he
meshes. The problem is, he was used as the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
And I think, like, there's a problem in that.
And it's just like, oh, here we go. Oh, someone, you know, there's a fucking, like, emergency computer. Who are we going to call? Cyborg. Like, to me, he's a lame character. Like, I've always found him incredibly lame. Like, he used to look so bad back in, like, the early 80s. Look at some of the new Teen Titans stuff where you, like, you feel sorry for him. He looks so stupid. Whereas now they try to, like, dick him out with, like, the big arm blast cannon and stuff, so he actually looks cooler, at least.
Yeah, they try to make him a little more edgy, I suppose.
Yeah, like that's as far as they've ever got him with me. I've never thought much of him, but as some of the stuff you're saying over there, Stu, is, I think, a lot more interesting. And would, you know, play to audiences, because, like, you know, there's got to be someone out there who likes him. There's got to be someone out there who's, like, wants more Cyborg. I can't think of who that person would be, but there's got to be someone who's like, where's my Cyborg? Because DC spent enough time trying to make us, you know, believe it.
I mean, the other big problem is when we got Cyborg in the movies, we got no backstory. We didn't like the character before there was that tragic accident.
No.
So we felt nothing for him when the accident happened.
He was just the guy who was hanging around all the boxes.
He was a walking computer. Boxes. He was just a walking computer that entire movie.
Yeah, I thought he sucked, personally.
Like, yeah, he was a plot device. He wasn't a character.
Now, Disney have officially closed the deal with Fox as of midnight March 20. Some sad news, about 4,000 to 10,000 people stand to lose their jobs with the merger. Disney's already shedding staff at several of the production offices. In terms of news that we at The Signal are obviously focused on, beyond just the sheer accumulation of IPs that they've now got, which is now available on their site, by the way, Stu, do you think there's any chance of an X-Men Easter egg or one-line mention of mutants in Endgame?
No.
None at all? Like, not even like a little tinsy-winsy Easter egg?
Nope.
Okay. All right.
Film was edited, cut, shipped out before March 20.
Sure.
Legally, they couldn't do it.
Well, okay. I mean, so you don't think there's even going to be like a one line, like little fade out, like kind of thing?
No, because if they put it in there, that would have been illegal.
They can put it out now. They can put it in now.
It's too late to do it now. The movie has already been cut, edited, and shipped out.
Okay.
Like, there's physical copies of the movie.
I think you're
right.
If I'm betting my house on it, I think you're right. I don't know. Again, there was people who've been. Some people, I think, really think this Fox Disney deal is just all about fucking X-Men. Like, they really have a very limited view of the universe. Like, the sheer amount of IPs that Disney now own is staggering. Right. It's actually staggering.
This isn't Disney's number one priority.
I know.
Like, let's be completely honest. Disney already have a very successful superhero franchise.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I think
you
it's
look
a,
at the
I
Avengers,
think it is a priority.
They're making billions of dollars. Yeah. They're not desperate to have that extra one or two movies a year with X-Men.
I think it's a priority, but I don't think it's their number one priority.
It's certainly a profitable venture for them to go down, and I think they're going to do that very quickly because it is so profitable.
But you're right. It's not
they didn't do this for it, and it's not like we need to get it done by this date so we can do it in Endgame.
Yeah.
There's plenty
more movies to come. Like, Endgame's not going to be the last movie that Marvel made, no matter what.
Marvel and Disney are hoping that we're not even halfway through.
I mean, people out there, Stu, are saying stuff like, do you think there'll be more Marvel Avengers movies after Endgame? It's like,
yes, they've already confirmed this.
There'll be fucking very many, guys. Like, you fucking idiots.
They've already signed contracts for them. Like, it's a sure thing at this point.
I just find that sometimes the public is so fucking gullible, and they're fed it by these sites, Stu, and they come up, because I do the news, some of the stuff that even I won't pick up off the news, it's like, these sites feed, like, their sort of really biased news to, like, their people, and they're sort of making them believe, like, Endgame could potentially be the last Avengers movie you'll ever see.
Well, yeah, because that's clickbait. That's how they sell everything now.
It's just lame.
Like, it works, though.
Incredibly lame.
Yeah, but that's the same as putting a number one on a comic book cover. It's the same as... Sure. Those YouTube videos where you click on it and 20 minutes in, you're going, why am I sitting here for 20 minutes? I'm wasting my life.
I'm glad that I'm not doing that. You know what I mean? Like, when I see these YouTube...
I mean, to an extent, you are, because you're talking about the news articles that you kind of read
A little bit.
But like, it affects everybody on the internet.
Of course. But if you're sitting there for 20 minutes on a YouTube video, like Logan Paul, for example, like, you've really got to be looking...
Oh, yeah, that's sad.
It is really sad. I agree. It's
bizarre. But, yeah, no. Look, at the end of the day, this movie was... completely edited and sent out to production houses and like it is done and it has been done for around a month.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Stu.
So a significant amount of time has gone between that movie's final kind of editing stage.
Yeah. And I'm sure Feige has down to a fine art how he wants to introduce X-Men and Fantastic Four. He will have a very sort of deliberate...
At this point, it's also been so built up in the media that they've kind of got to stick this landing now.
Yes.
It's the same as a Captain Marvel movie. Like, there was so much talk...
There's a lot of pressure.
...about how much money they'd spent just hiring Brie Larson. And, like, all those articles that came out saying, is she overpaid because she didn't get paid She got more pay than Black Panther and all this sort of...
Useless articles.
Man. More clickbaity kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, she got paid whatever she demanded and they agreed to. That's exactly how it happened.
The saddest thing was, like, the trolls who really tried so hard to make that movie sink, and then obviously it didn't sink, and they're like,
it's no, Marvel did what they normally do and they stuck the landing.
Like, they, if those guys had the power to see Captain Marvel, I'd be fucking impressed.
And because, remember how there were heavy, heavy rumors that we were going to get an Easter egg of her in Civil War?
Vaguely, yeah.
Because at the time, they the very end scene in the hangar, when Cap kind of halfway gets through saying Avengers Assemble before it cuts to black, there are actually spots in that hangar that were green screen.
Okay.
Just a green screen sitting there in the middle of the hangar,
right.
So they could digitally put in a character.
Well, there was also a lot of talk, I think, in Age of Ultron, I remember, that Spider-Man would be in it. Of course, he turned up
in Civil War.
In Civil War. But there was, like, heavy talk to the point where people like me were getting really excited.
Yeah, and then exactly
I was
kind of
let down. I was like, that was one point where I was like, well, don't listen to the rumour machine building your expectations. That's where I am with Palpatine in episode
9. Both cases, I wasn't upset with the intro that the character got.
That was great.
Like, Spidey's intro was close to perfect.
I think it was fantastic.
Close to perfect, cutting to that, like, big Queen's banner, and then we went over there. I wouldn't want him in a tiny Easter egg in Ultron.
Standing there in the Spider-Man, Iron Man suit. Like, wouldn't
maybe showing up 5 minutes too late and then walking away disappointed or some dumb comedic beat.
Yeah.
I'd much rather him have... A proper scene that was well crafted by Disney and Marvel.
Me too.
And we get a decent intro.
Yeah.
That's what I want for Wolverine. That's what I want for Professor X. Like, I want a really, really good scene.
I mean, I'm on record for my Wolverine. Like, I want it to be damn good how they introduce him. I think it's going to be crucial.
And I'm happy to have him introduced in almost any movie.
I don't care.
I don't really care what. I don't want him introduced in Guardians 3. Like, something that's just a weird place to put them.
I don't want, like... Remember when they did the Return of Wolverine, he was turning up in bars 5 minutes after everyone left? That sucked so hard. Do you remember?
Yeah.
We covered a few of them in the comics. Like, he was just walking into the bar.
Yeah, showing up 5 minutes too late to the hospital. That's
lame as hell. Like,
you see, I don't want that.
I don't want that at all.
What felt like a very poor attempt at shoehorning a character into a book.
It was just stupid. Like, I think it was just to get the real diehards to buy that book. Like, the real diehards. When we were diehards, we read the first two before. We're like, what are we doing with our lives? Like, Wolverine literally is turning up with nothing to do.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
Whereas it's very different from when he was in the bar scene where Charles and Xavier walk up.
Mm-hmm.
Ask him to join the team. He tells him to fuck off, and they leave.
That was fine.
In about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
See, that's a great Easter egg because we'd seen him so many times before and so many times since. It's right in the middle of a long run.
We knew who the character was,
and they didn't leak it everywhere. They didn't tell everyone Wolverine's in the movie. You should see the movie. He wasn't in the first trailer. He was.
Dude, one of the parts of Apocalypse I liked was when they showed Wolverine in the Weapon X. Yeah. I actually liked that, and it came as a surprise for me.
Exactly right.
You know,
and it was very true to the comic books.
Yeah, it was good. In a weak movie, I thought that part lifted the movie, and some people were going, oh, it ruined the whole film. I'm like, I thought it was a bright spot in a pretty lackluster movie.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I think it fucks around with timelines significantly, but,
yeah, but what does
that whole franchise of movies was a terrible mindfuck when it came to timelines. That
series, I remember, Stu, we were on a train one time, and you and I, I think one of your friends, were talking about the X-Men timeline in the movies, and we were all confused. When we start puzzling over it, it's a very confusing ball of wax.
Well, you've kind of got to view it as like a splintered timeline, where there's three or four different lines of history, and we've seen into three or four of them.
Mm.
At different times.
In fairness, the comics do that. I mean, X-Men Apocalypse and all that.
The comics do that, but I think they're asking a bit much of a casual moviegoer.
Well, they also don't explain it really very well at all.
No, they don't.
It's just sort of like...
Like in Days of Future Past, that kind of apocalyptic future was on a completely different timeline to what everyone else was in.
Yeah. Which is what happens in the comics too. Like the Age of Apocalypse comics, that timeline where Apocalypse, I assume, is basically one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sort of okay with it. I wish when they did it, they would have just explained it, but they didn't. They just chose not to explain it. They just sort of chose...
They tried explaining it once, and they did that pebble in a pond or pebble in a river. Doesn't change the flow of the river, and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
They tried to use Beast to explain...
The concept, I understand, but the payoff inside the movies didn't really make any sense.
No, it wasn't good.
Because in all those movies, they were trying to do stuff. Like, even in Wolverine Origins, they show the bit where Charles Xavier turns up. Remember with the de-aged Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
And, like, it's like, you still, guys are still desperately trying to make it all fit together, but, like, you're not doing a very good job.
And I'll tell you what, like, Deadpool 2 introduced time travel into their universe.
Yes.
And in one movie, got it right.
Yeah.
They show that you travel back in time, you make a change, the future changes.
Mm.
Like, they showed that this is one timeline that you can change by going back in time. And they just kind of said, this is what happens now. If we change something in the past, the future gets changed.
Hmm.
And instantly you kind of understand what's happening.
Which is the Back to the Future way as well.
Yeah, there's three or four significant models of time travel that we kind of have in.
I thought the way they did it in the comics was that in the comics, they're very, especially in X-Men comics, they're very comfortable in Marvel comics with the idea that you, if an event changes, it just creates a parallel
universe. Yeah, in the comics at the moment, they're very keen on multiverses.
Yeah.
The idea that if you change something in the past, you've created two futures.
I used to love
that. The original one that you had and the new one where the change kicked it off.
I used to love that, but I think as it's proliferated more and more, it's had less impact on me.
You know? Well, I mean, yeah, it has to, because now there's thousands of different multiverses.
But they're also a bit too keen to sort of, like, I hate to sound like this, but they're just a bit too keen to just, it's almost like it's an excuse to sell another toy. Like, you know what I mean?
Well,
like,
yeah, because then you get five different versions of Wolverine, and all of a sudden you can sell five different...
Yeah, and, like, but, like, they don't do anything much else with it other than that?
No, every few years they have a culling of multiverses.
Yeah.
They normally turn to the Fantastic Four and say, how many can you collapse in one arc?
And, like, look, when that's done well, like, in Hickman's Avengers, which was all about that, that was excellent. But, like, they rarely show that level of ambition. You know, like, that was
rare. No, but that was them basically saying, we've got too many multiverses, let's cull it all down.
Yeah.
And now they've started it all over again.
I guess what
I'm saying week is, we read the first Spider-Man issue from a brand new multiverse.
From the game.
The Gameiverse.
Yeah.
Like, they've just started a whole new line of comics.
I don't mind. I mean, it's...
At some point, you know there's going to be a crossover between that universe and the regular universe that we have.
Sure, but I'm not exactly sitting here with bated breath for that.
No, but that's how they do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got a way to write a whole nother title of Spider-Man, a good selling comic book. I think I'm just
a little older and a little less excited by that kind of stuff than I was.
Every time it happens, you get used to it, and it becomes less novel, and you start losing.
Like, Age of Apocalypse in X-Men, and I wasn't a massive X-Men reader in the 90s, but I know when that Age of Apocalypse, they did it for the whole year, through all the X-Men titles. It was just massive. It was a huge seller for Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, and they forever tried to basically copy that model. And I feel probably less and less success, but hey, well, I mean, a good story is a good story.
Yeah, the human mind perceives things very differently. It's why a summer holiday now as an adult feels much shorter than it did when you were a kid.
Sure.
Even if it was the same length of time, same location, same everything.
Uh-huh.
Because now if you go away for 1 year even, let's say it's a 30th or a 40th of your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a tiny little sliver.
Mm.
Whereas when you're seven, it's a seventh of your life. It's a massive chunk of time.
I see. Okay.
So you perceive it as, like, a much more important thing, even though it's...
Yeah, the same.
Objectively, the same amount of time.
Yeah,
same thing happens in comic books. If you've seen the same story 10 times, you read it and go, okay, this is the 11th time I've read this.
True.
I know the beats that are coming. Cool story, different characters. Yes, it's great, but...
Especially if they're not doing anything particularly new.
You know? Very hard to do things brand new after 80-odd years of superhero comics.
Or for me, if they do it without any depth. I always found guys like Morrison, Moore, Brubaker, Rucker, they imparted a level of depth, which I found more interesting than, like, some of the comics I read now. Like, not all of them, but some, especially some of the Marvel stuff. I'm like, wow, there's almost like... no character work whatsoever. Like, you know, it's banter only. Like, everyone.
Yeah, I mean, they are relying on you to have read the last year or so.
Yeah.
That's their kind of
business
model at the moment, it seems.
It's interesting. Now, Stu, I don't know if you saw this story. Warner's chairman and CEO, Kevin Tushihara, is stepping down from his role in the wake of a recent scandal involving an Australian actress who had ties to James Packer. I don't know if you saw this article. It ran in the Hollywood Reporter. Basically, you know, your typical Me Too movement, like, you know, sex for roles kind of scandal, and he had to step down. This was the guy who was shepherding all the Warner's movies quite successfully and, like, transitioning them.
I mean, he's only been in the role for a year, 2 years?
Yeah, and he was actually tapped to even take a greater... Before this incident, this report came out on March 6th, he was actually getting more power at Warner's and getting quite a high level of power, but he's now stepped down from the role following...
Well, in his brief tenure there, he's done things like push forward this Shazam project.
Mm, yeah. So he moved it away from the... after the disappointment of Justice League,
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
And, like, he was kind of... He got that role because he was so heavily involved in the Aquaman thing, wasn't he?
I think so, yeah. I think he took a lot of credit for that.
So, I mean, after Aquaman came out and did so well, like, he looked even more confident and, like, a better choice. And all of a sudden, he's got these allegations against him and...
Well, she went to the papers.
Clearly, it's enough that he stepped down.
I read this. The story made press here in Australia because it involved... Not involved, but was, like... had ties to the Rat Pack production company of James Packer with Brett Ratner. And so there was some ties. Not really anything he'd done wrong, but just that she had ties to him and, you know, there was some text exchange.
I mean, you don't leave a job like that over a hollow allegation. I mean...
Oh, no. I think...
Clearly something's gone on here.
She was texting... It's been in the papers, dude. She was texting James Packer going, he's not even nice, all he wants to do is fuck. And, you know, she was trying to get roles. Basically, that was what she was doing. It was like sex for roles, and it just didn't pay off. And, you know, eventually went to the papers, and hence he lost his job. It's amazing what these guys...
So, in a weird way, he was actually being professional by not giving her the job.
Stupid defense.
Does that make sense? Like,
yeah, I don't know if that... I feel like
he'd be more guilty if he was giving her all these roles, and then it got found out.
But unfortunately, that's where it backfires you, because she went to the papers over it.
Said, I've been willingly having sex with this man.
Well, I don't know if she went to the papers.
On the understanding that I would get a role, and he never...
Someone went to the papers because they had all the texts, but she released a statement saying there was no impropriety, but very much after the story had broken in Hollywood Reporter. So... there was a whole mishmash of what was going on. But the allegations themselves were quite funny, that she was basically having sex with him to get roles, and then the roles didn't happen, and she wasn't happy. You know. I mean, toss the fucking girl a role. Like, Jesus, how hard... Like, some of the shit the Rat Pack, you know, group produced during their...
I don't know. I feel like... Put it this way. He could have very easily just given her a role. And then she could have blackmailed him for the rest of her career.
We don't know what kind of... Like, in all fairness, like, what she was like as an actress. I've never heard of her in my life. Like, the first time I heard of her was the newspaper article.
I don't know. If she's anywhere near as good as Ruby Rose, then she's...
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Definitely should not be in the
plenty of bad actresses, though, in Hollywood, and bad actors. Like, they're not alone. Like, there are blocks of wood. Like, I'll say this. Liam Hemsworth? I think he's a terrible actor.
Chris Hemsworth? Oh, really?
What I've seen him in, he's just not impressed me. Joy Courtney, for a long time, very unimpressive, but turned up in a lot of stuff. Sam Worthington, I thought he was, like, almost as interesting as a block of wood.
I've never liked Sam Worthington.
Like, I'm just naming guys who I don't think sparkle at all, you know what I mean? But they get a lot of roles.
I think Liam Hemsworth can act.
Yeah, maybe he can. I actually think
all three of the Hemsworth brothers can act.
Okay. Who's the third one? I don't even know the third one.
Luke.
Like, I'm not familiar with him.
He's mostly done TV work. He was in Westworld. He's got a decent role in Westworld.
Hey, look, Liam Hemsworth seems like a nice guy, and I wish him all the best. I'm just saying, I've not seen anything where he's blown me away, but he's a pretty face, you know. Who knows? I mean, Chris Hemsworth.
Look, he's better than half those kind of guys you're naming then. Like,
Sam Worthington.
Worthington shouldn't have been an actor.
Sam Worthington and Joy Courtney, I've seen them in movies where I'm like, I'm surprised you've got a Hollywood career.
Oh, Jai Courtney has the world's greatest team behind him, because...
He must be beating them on price too or something.
He's done, I think, five or six absolute flops of movies?
Yeah.
Like, including killing off the Die Hard franchise.
He's terrible in that movie. He's terrible.
Like, he had significant flops.
The only movie that I liked him in was him playing Boomerang in Suicide Squad. I actually thought he was funny. I didn't like the movie, but his performance I actually thought was quite good. And everything else I've seen him in, like Terminator Genesis, and another one we just mentioned then, The Die Hard. I mean, I thought it was appalling.
Frankly. Yeah, they were. Die Hard was terrible.
It was
terrible.
Awful. Like, for such a good franchise, that was such a stinker of a movie. Bruce Willis was phoning it in that movie. Like, you couldn't...
Oh, believe. Bruce didn't help. Bruce didn't help at all.
It was like someone had turned him off. You know what I mean? Like,
I haven't seen a really good Bruce Willis role in a while, though.
Oh, he doesn't do many.
He did Looper. I thought he was pretty good in Looper.
Very good in Looper.
But I can't think of another film recently where he hasn't been kind of phoning it in.
Does a lot of director streaming stuff now. I mean, Death Wish, he was okay, I thought. I thought he was okay in Death Wish, actually.
I just keep seeing movies where he's kind of meh in.
Yeah, I agree.
Like Red and Red 2, he was...
Yeah, I saw both, and I didn't think that they were as good as what people were saying. I thought they were okay.
I liked the movies, yeah, but Bruce Willis in them was not good.
I think Bruce has kind of turned off, you know? Like, he's counting his money, and he's just happy, and
it feels like it, doesn't
acting
it?
Is no longer, like, really the reason he gets out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
This was interesting, Stu. I wanted to know what you thought of this. I meant to mention last week, Marvel is apparently planning a What If series for Disney Plus. I think it's animated, Stu. I mean, this sounds like something that would be really cool.
Yeah, this sounds great. Like an animated, I'm thinking like a kid's version of like a Black Mirror, where you've got okay. the same superhero universe. Maybe they get, I don't know, 20 characters,
mm-hmm.
like 20 big characters. Sure. Each episode is a completely new take, completely new world.
It'd be great.
Mash the characters together in a weird way and what if?
Like just classic what ifs. Like what if Captain America really died in World War II, you know? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, that's what ifs are, aren't they? I remember the first, one of the first comics I ever bought was my first comic I ever bought with my own money was Iron Man. And I think the second one was a what if Iron Man was a traitor? And it was so fucking interesting. You know, like it went back to the original Vietnam War incident and, you know, he basically was a bit of a turncoat and formed the Avengers but still had allegiances to the Viet Cong or something. And the Fantastic Four, and I was like, I was a new reader. I was like, man, this is exciting stuff. Like, it just hooked me in. Like, I think a lot of the What If hooks were fantastic.
I think it's a very novel idea. I think it has to have a lot of novelty to it. Kids film works.
Yeah.
Like, kids TV show really works.
Yeah.
I think if they want to make this long-lasting, I don't think it'll work. Right. I think people get very tired of the same
yeah.
What If scenario.
But there are a lot of What Ifs they can do.
Oh, there's an infinite number of what ifs they could do, but
they have done. They can.
That doesn't mean all the what ifs are great.
No, I mean I haven't read. Have you read many? I've read probably five or six.
I'm probably around the same. Like I think you pick up a book and you read a few of them, and you're like, that's a pretty cool idea, but yeah. then you put it down and you never yeah. think of it again. You know,
I kind of agree.
It's like, a one and done. Okay, that was.
Like, what if Iron Man was a traitor? Set the bar for me very high, and the next what if I was like, this isn't quite as interesting.
Well, you know, there's the obvious, like, what if Thor was never worthy of the hammer?
Sure.
And you kind of go on this Asgardian story where he becomes, like, a normal foot soldier and gets overshadowed by the Warriors.
Some of the what ifs are really dark because they're, like, really quite sort of, you know, intense. Like, some of them...
Yeah, see, was if you're going to spin it for, like, a kid's show...
Sure.
You could go completely out of the box. Like, bonkers crazy. Like, what if Iron Man was a cow?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you've got Iron Cow.
I'd hate that personally.
And like
for kids, yeah.
For kids, that works. And that's yeah. kind of, if you could write it well enough, it could be hilarious for 10 minutes.
So you'd like it to sort of almost be, I mean, could it be kind of really bizarre, like Rick and Morty kind of bizarre?
I love Rick and Morty. I think that's.
I've been watching Rick and Morty recently. I think it's fantastic. Like,
it's a great show.
That's what I'm saying. Could they go that kind of like really.
Any show that can turn their main character into a pickle for a whole episode. Like, they've gone balls to the wall crazy. I love it.
I did mention this to you, actually. I started watching one when Michelle wasn't here. I watched, like, four episodes in a row. It's actually really good.
Yeah.
Like,
it's fantastic. I watched
really appealed to my humour.
Yeah.
It's also a bit more action-adventure than I expected.
Oh, absolutely. Like, very much. It's very much like a Fantastic Four-ish kind of story.
Which is crazy.
But then every now and again it gets super dark.
Yeah.
I thought was really fun.
Yeah, it's a real mesh of concepts.
Yeah.
It, the guy who did Communities, and Dan Harmon's behind it, one of the people behind it, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the creator of the show, Dan Harmon.
See, I must admit, like, I came in through the back door on Community and I watched most of it and was always very impressed, but, like, was surprised I was impressed. Like, my expectations weren't high. And I was like, this is actually quite good. And
Rick I and fell Morty, in love with Community. And
Community
then
was excellent, yeah.
I was late to get on the bandwagon for Rick and Morty. I think I started it maybe this time last year kind of thing.
Okay. Well, me too. But like so many people I know have said how good it is.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I just happened to be sitting there and it was on Netflix. You know, I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch it. I watched one episode. I was like, wow, I liked that a lot more than I expected.
Like, and it's a much cleverer show than you think when you first watch it as well.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be really kiddie.
No, you can. The other thing is you can go back and watch episodes and get more nuances out of them.
Mm.
So, like, Dan intentionally wrote one episode. I won't tell you which one. Hmm. But there was an episode where Rick doesn't drink for the entire episode.
Right, yeah.
And it was a choice that they made. They've done a pretty obvious thing to kind of counterbalance it. But for a whole episode, he wasn't belching or drinking at all.
Sure.
Because he was this whole other thing. But you don't notice it until you go back and watch it and go, holy shit, they just replaced his drinking habit with something else.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious once you know it's there that it's a whole joke for an episode that they just put in there. And then you kind of get these nuanced views.
Well, the Dan Harmon, he's a clever guy, I think. Like, the kind of stuff he's doing, it's very funny. But there is a thread of, like, there's a bit of intelligence behind it all as well.
Apparently, he's actually quite difficult to work with. A lot of actors...
Oh, I've heard he's a prick.
Yeah, a lot of actors have said he's... not on their level at all.
Well, I've listened to his podcast, and he's definitely prickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell.
Like, well, and I think it's because he's had two successful shows now.
Yeah.
Where he's kind of being lauded as this comedic genius in his writing.
Sure.
That he's figuring out ways to put these characters together in stories that have these amazing twists and reveals that you just can't predict.
Yeah.
And it all seems to work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the you know, fame and money, I'm sure, is going to his head nicely as well.
Yeah, exactly. So he starts going, if it's not my vision, it's not worth doing. He's got
the classic case of, like, you know, mounting a blow and just, like, writing his scripts and, you know.
Well, apparently he's up until, like, 3 or 4 in the morning writing and then...
Hey, look,
like, man, starts at 6 a.m. and he's on set and he hasn't slept and showered.
You
don't
stay hot forever, so you may as well do it while you're there, you know? Like, you won't stay hot, you know, forever and ever and ever, so you may as well produce as much as you can, you know, while the fucking momentum's going your way. Well, you've got these shows, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think there's an argument to be made for someone like a Ricky Gervais who had one massively successful show.
Sure.
And then has more or less coasted after that. Like, he's had other successful shows, but it was never a rush to get it out. It was never a push. It was always, I've got enough money now that I can spend a year writing and then come out with a movie or come out with a TV show. And...
yeah, he works at a more relaxed pace.
He's definitely chilled out a little bit since the first run of The Office just ended. And
he had Office and he had Extras and then he's had other things, but they haven't been quite as high profile, have they?
Well, yeah, Extras was his next biggest thing, but he did a movie between them and...
The Invention of Lying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it. I don't mind Ricky Gervais, but I agree. But Dan Harmon is more, I think, more in your classic Hollywood mold. Like, he's just pumping it out.
Dan Harmon's a little more... he's way more intense.
Yeah. To be fair, it's working for him. Like, Rick and Morty's a big franchise. I mean,
clearly that creative process works for him, so...
go for it.
And there's a lot to be said for that.
Obviously, Stu, you're the Game of Thrones guy here. I do know who Sansa Stark is. And
good.
There was two Esquire articles in the last 3 days on it. Well, the first one says that she'll win everything, win the Game of Thrones. What's your take on that, Stu? Sansa Stark.
She's certainly a contender. I think it's a dark horse pick.
The next day, today, Esquire ran an article saying she's definitely going to die. So Esquire's arguing with itself, it seems.
I don't know if she's going to die. What I want to ask the people is, and I don't know the answer to this, so I'm actually...
Are you asking me?
No, I'm not asking you. I'm asking the people who might know. Okay.
All right.
What's the significance of the feather in the crypts under Winterfell? We've seen it in a trailer now for the new season. When they first go down into the crypts, there is a feather...
what did you say?
On the floor, they pick up.
What?
I'm not talking to you, Dave. Dave's got no fucking idea what's going on. There is a feather in the crypts under Winterfell.
Oh, okay.
You fucking moron sometimes, Dave.
I've not seen it.
I know you haven't seen it. That's why I'm not talking to you. There's been like 3 or 4 references to them going to the crypts. Is it something to do with the Three-Eyed Raven? I don't know. Like, there is...
I'd say so. I'd say so, man. I'd say it's got something to do with the Raven.
Oh, really? You'd say that? Based on your extensive knowledge of...
Before you cast aspersions at me, I've watched a fair amount of Game of Thrones.
Do you want to know why I don't think it's a Three-Eyed Raven? It's not a black feather. It's not a raven's feather.
Is it a white feather?
No.
That's a shame.
It looks like this weird mottled grey, maybe an owl or something.
Frankly, I don't know.
But they've made a big deal of it in the recent trailer. Like, there's actually a full scene devoted to... I think it's Arya or Sansa picking it up.
The sad part is, when Stu was saying this question, I was really hoping I would know the answer just by fluke. And then when you said it, I actually didn't even understand what you said.
I know, you've got no fucking clue.
No, I don't know the answer. And maybe out of the computer, someone out there, Tommy Cavell, someone can bring the answer for Stu. I mean,
I don't know. Like, there's something there. I don't know what it is.
I'm going to take a fucking guess. I'm going to say an undead raven. a White Walker Raven.
Okay, Dave's got a 0% chance of getting that one right. But
well, I'm taking a shot, man.
Yeah.
An undead raven, man, killed. What, actually, not 100% sure on this.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure either, Dave. But
if a White Walker kills a raven, does it just turn into a White Walker raven?
Like, I mean,
what does it take to turn into one?
Well, it's got to die, and then it's got to be in the presence of the Night King or one of the White Walkers.
So if the White King snapped the back Night King snapped the back of a raven in his hand, that would turn into a...
Well, he doesn't have to kill it. It just has to be dead, and he has to be in its presence.
Well, that's my guess.
Because, like, the Battle of Hardhome, like, hundreds of wildlings or free folk, whatever you call them, died. Each to the battle.
Yeah.
Like, whites versus people, they all died, and they all got brought back to life.
Just because they were in his power.
Yeah, he raised his hands. This is, one of the most famous scenes from season 6 or 7. Like, one of the most recent seasons as well.
I remember that dragon. That traumatized me. Because I'm still in stunned shock about what happened to that dragon. That one keeps me up at night sometimes. I mean, what happened there? He tossed a spear at it. And then the spear, though, was cursed with kind of his power, wasn't it? Like one of his javelins, you know?
Well, yeah.
Like the Olympics when he threw that fucking javelin.
Yeah, the insanely it was strong.
A decent throw.
It was a very decent throw. But yeah, he threw it, it pierced the dragon. We're assuming it like pierced his heart or something.
Okay, yeah. Killed it.
Killed it. The dragon landed in the ice lake.
Uh-oh.
Very dead.
Yeah.
They dragged it up and the Night King walked up to it and kind of...
Did he touch it? Or
he put his hand on his snout, nose, whatever it is.
Wow.
And the dragon wakes up.
Tough scene for me.
But he like just lifted his hands before and giants and men and women and everyone just stood up after they'd been killed.
How do you beat someone like that, man? I don't understand how. Like,
they've already showed you how they beat it. Like they've laid all the breadcrumbs for it.
Shit about like dragon glass and Valyrian steel.
Yeah.
So if Valyrian steel chopped his head off, that'd be the end of him.
Yeah, and not only that, if you kill one of the White Walkers, everything that he reanimated dies.
Okay, so they have set it up then, so...
Yeah, they've set that up previously, like just before that dragon died in that scene that you remember. Actually,
to be honest, Joe, I'm glad you're here, because you're really setting me up nicely for this new season. A lot of facts are kind of like coming through the old brain now.
Do you know what sets you up even better?
What?
Watching the show.
Yeah, but I don't have that kind of time. And I've watched the last few episodes, the last few seasons, sorry.
Sansa is an outside chance. I think she's about level footing with someone like Tyrion. Sitting on the Iron Throne.
Okay.
They're continually saying how good Tyrion was at ruling and how brilliant he was as a leader.
Yeah.
So they're kind of setting up the idea that someone will eventually go, I don't want to be the guy on the throne or the girl on the throne.
Yeah.
Tyrion, you're better at this job. I think you would be the best ruler.
Fair enough. I do want to... We do have a... I'll bring it up now between Game of Thrones. Daenerys... Apparently when she... what's her name? Emilia Clarke? Is that right?
Yeah, Emilia
Clarke apparently had to have 3 glasses of wine and was wandering around London for hours by herself when she found out the fate of herself in Game of Thrones in the final season, which doesn't bode well, you would think.
No, that actually doesn't mean anything. She does that after she reads every script.
Okay. Well,
it's actually quite a famous thing that she does.
Secondly, she has had 2 brain aneurysms during the show. And... which was
probably from all the wine and walking.
It's not good, though. I mean, 2 brain aneurysms, that's in such a young woman, that's terrible.
Not good.
Why is she alive? Like, but yeah, apparently she was in incredible pain. She said she's 100% recovered, but I read it and I was like, Jesus, like that's hardcore. So, Stu, you're saying that that's just normal actress behavior from her?
It's actually not just from her. Like, a lot of these actors and actresses will kind of read the scripts and then do whatever they do, whatever their process is.
Sure.
Kind of having to figure out how their characters are meant to react to all this. And
do you think she's going to die, though, Stu? Because that's going to be a tough scene for me. She's always been one of my favourites. Like, I've always actually... To be honest, I've always followed her story quite closely. And
oh, really? Whose story?
Daenerys. Do you think she'll die? You know, what are the chances? I thought the chances were good of ruling. I've always felt she's one of the... She's always been one of my picks.
I don't think you ever put money against George R. R. Martin killing a character.
Yeah, true.
I think he's made it very clear from day one that he's very happy to kill anybody.
Oh, yeah. Anyone's on the chopping block. Now, Stu, probably time for you to cough up an apology. Domain ran an article on Hugh Jackman's property portfolio.
Oh, okay.
It actually hit the Facebook page,
And let me tell you, Stu, how many times have I said during the course of this show that you've underestimated his property portfolio? And what was the numbers that I said he was worth? Did I say $200 million?
I can't remember what you said. You had some crazy outlandish number, but...
Well, I don't think you take into account his property portfolio, not to mention his coffee business that he's now got in the States. That would be valued probably, you know, 20 to 50 million, I think, the valuation on that. So, I mean, when we take all these things into the equation, I think Hugh's comfortably over 100 million now. Would you agree? If we're taking into account his properties.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you were saying he has $200 million worth of property alone at one point.
Well, I mean,
you were overestimating to the extreme. He's not worth $200 million at all, let alone just in property. He's.
You don't think?
No.
He's banking at what these X Men movies of Gav.
I imagine his net worth is probably around $130 to $140 million
US.
I would probably say Australian, but it could be US. I don't know. Like, I wouldn't.
Okay. All right, but it's fascinating that the main Brennan article on just how successful his property empire is.
Do they put a value on it? Do they put a dollar value?
Unfortunately, they didn't go into detail for me.
Okay, well, in that case, there's not going to be an apology from Stu on this one.
What they spoke
about... You're going to get nothing out of me.
What they spoke about a lot was that he bought his first property for about $280,000 with his wife at the time back in about, I mean, you know, early 90s before Wolverine. Maybe he even bought it in like 87, actually. And that he's been quietly buying property in Sydney ever since. And think of how the property market's exploded since the late 80s to now, Stu. Like, stuff that you bought for $200,000 could be worth, like, $2 million now. Like, frankly. That's before he got his Hollywood wealth. So, as far as I'm concerned, Stu, I do think it's almost time for you to cough out an apology, and I'll be looking forward to it.
Like, you can think that all you like, bro. But while you're still spouting out, he's worth $200 million in property alone.
No, I'm not.
Minimum. Saying, the guy's a billionaire by now.
I'm not saying it's $200 million worth of property. I'm saying you're not taking into account his coffee business, how well that's doing as well.
Yeah, and it's exploded in the last 12 months
as well. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. And that's nudging.
Nothing to do with his property holdings.
But I'm talking about his whole net worth now. And I think it's
still nowhere near
approaching $200 million.
It's heading that way, but it's not there.
If only we could get you on the show to go through this in more detail.
Thing is, you've been saying $200 million for years now. And, like, he's added a significant chunk of that in the last 12 months with the coffee.
The coffee business.
So, I mean, I feel like if you keep saying a number, you're just hoping one year it'll eventually be right.
Well, one thing that's not helping me now is there's currently a property slump.
Like 15 years from now, when you're like, is he worth $200 million yet? I'm like, yes, Dave, he's worth $200 million.
Q streamers.
Like, you're just going to try to outweight me. Is that the plan here?
Oh, definitely. That's the worst part of my plan. I mean, look, when we get Hugh on the show, I won't say it'll be a full in-depth, fiscal review of what's going on at his end, but like, it'll come up for sure.
I'm surprised you're not asking him to submit the last 5 years of tax returns.
Like, I would like to see, you know, take us off book Hugh as well. Like, check
his wallet for cash. He may have a bit of cash.
What else have you got there?
Yeah, going to check under his mattress as well, just to make sure.
I'm sure he's got some stashed away, man.
Oh. At least $10 million under the mattress, Dave. I mean, the man's worth $500 million,
don't
after all.
Don't forget the rental income he's bringing in as well from all these properties.
Oh, he's getting up to $1 billion now, isn't he? He must be.
Maybe he takes Warren Buffett's tips. I don't know.
Well, I don't know, mate. Well, he's one kidney shy of the billion. Like, he sells a little kidney.
He's got plenty in the bank, man, is all I'm saying. And I think that, I mean, I won't harp on about it, but I do think this coffee business is adding a significant portion to the empire at this point in time. And I will say, I won't say any more on the topic. Okay, now, according to Deadline, James Cameron's return to the Terminator franchise Dark Fate has a release date of November 1 this year. They go, Charlie's Angels hits theaters the same day. I mean,
I'm not excited about either of those two films.
I wouldn't. I'm definitely
at all, not really.
Charlie's Angels. Will you see Dark Fate in the cinemas? I will. No. Michelle's a huge fan of Terminator.
I'm closer to seeing Charlie's Angels than Dark Fate.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
honestly, James Cameron's name doesn't mean a lot to me when it comes to Terminator. I think.
Really?
I don't think it helps. I don't think anything can save Terminator at this point. I think it's beyond redemption.
You don't think Tim Miller directing, the Deadpool director, and he's got a very active hand in apparently James Cameron as well.
I think the fact that they're trying to resurrect the not reboot.
Yeah.
Resurrect.
Yeah.
I don't care what else they put after that sentence.
Fair enough.
Like when they say Arnold Schwarzenegger's reprising his role, I'm already out.
That doesn't excite me.
I've already left the building. I don't care what else they say.
Well, to me, it's like you tried that with Genesis like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
You did that. And
yeah. Let's remind everyone how that went.
Yeah. I mean, poorly. It was entertaining at times, but it was certainly not compelling.
It's not good.
No.
Now, something I am excited about, Alex Winton and Keanu Reeves announced on a video, a short video in front of Hollywood Bowl, that Bill and Ted Face Their Music will arrive in theatres on August 21, 2020. And it was basically the two of them thanking the fans, Stu. Now, look, I come from the, you know, that early 90s culture where Bill and Ted were everything for a couple of years, Stu. I think this will be a Netflix release, and I will watch it happily. What do you think? I mean, I love Bill and Ted, the originals. Alex Winton and Keanu Reeves.
The originals? The originals? Hell yeah.
Well, Keanu Reeves has still got a career, you know.
But in that character role? His career now is very heavy John Wick.
Definitely.
Matrix.
Yeah.
Action hero.
But he does have charm, Keanu. I will say that about Keanu. He's always had a bit of charm to compensate for some wooden acting, you know.
I don't know. I'm not a big fan.
My cat is climbing, actually, the door. I've never seen him get so high as you. That was actually a very desperate move.
You've got a noisy pets now, Dave. Dogs barking or cats trying to meow us out.
But no, look, I agree with you. Bill and Ted Face the Music, this is pushing the envelope somewhat. Like, this is...
This really is another reboot that I'm not interested in.
Well, it's not a reboot. It is a sequel. Like, it's basically, the threat is they never came up with a song to save the world.
And I mean, sequel appeals even less than reboot. Let's be honest. This falls in the same category as Ghostbusters.
Yeah?
Love the originals. I'm not going to be seeing the new one in cinema.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll see Ghostbusters in cinemas.
Don't get me started on the all-female reboot that,
no, well, that
massively
was,
flopped.
That was just a boring movie.
These are concepts that hit the zeitgeist at the right time and struck a chord with audiences that were, like, charming and great films. They spawned a really nice sequel almost immediately after.
I prefer Bogus Journey to Excellent Adventure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then all of a sudden,
it's a long time
they kind of died off and you're like, great, that franchise has come and gone. It's lived a great life.
It was 91 or 92 when Bogus Journey came out. And I know because I was stoned out of my
mind. Yeah, and now they're looking at 30 years later.
It's a long time ago, man. Yeah, it's a long time.
I don't know. I'm just not excited about rebooting.
I don't see this as anything else other than this has got to be a Netflix release. I can't see people going to cinemas for this in great numbers. Like, I really can't. And I'm a Bill and Ted fan. But if you said to me it's on streaming tonight, I'd watch it. You know what I mean? Like, I think this has got to have a home theatre release.
See, I don't even know if I'd put it on my list of things to watch, maybe, but...
Yeah.
Like, it's right the way down that list.
I love the original, so I guess it's a nostalgia fact for me. And I actually do like Keanu Reeves. I've always had a soft spot for Keanu Reeves, to be honest. He's not a great actor, but I think he can be quite charming at times.
Yeah.
You know?
There's nothing wrong with Keanu. It's just...
It's the concept.
It's this role as well. I don't think...
Well, it's like bodacious, dude. Like, it's literally pretty.
Yeah.
Like, they were doing...
But it's like when they tried to reboot Dumb and Dumber.
Oh, it was terrible.
Which was just an awful movie.
Oh, it was so bad. But it was... Yeah, I agree with you.
Like, they're trying to go back to...
Dumb and Dumber was so dead, you know? Like, it was just so dead and over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you remember when it first came out and you were kind of... Like, that's a funny movie.
It was during Jim Carrey's just golden period where he...
Yeah, exactly right.
I mean, another Jim Carrey project... What would you do if they did Ace Ventura, Pet Detective? Because I love the original too. But, like, what if Jim Carrey got so desperate that he went back and did that?
I don't want to see Jim Carrey do it.
Yeah, you want to see someone else do it?
Like, if they redeveloped the character, start again?
Really? See, to me,
maybe
it's Jim Carrey or nothing to me. But even then, I'm like, wow, we've really waited a long time.
No, see, I don't particularly want to see Jim Carrey in a physical comedic role anymore. Because I don't think he can do it to the extent that he used to be able to.
Probably not.
So if I watch him now, I'm just constantly going to be thinking, that's not as good as he used to do.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, he makes a lot of choices these days. Like, he's all over the map. You know,
he had a couple of new shows, and he kind of went pretty deep into those roles.
Yeah.
Think like Joaquin Phoenix kind of level deep, where he spent...
Too deep.
Well, yeah, remember how Joaquin Phoenix spent like that year pretending to be
it was stupid.
That's the kind of thing that Jim's doing now. Like, he spent a year, like, in a studio painting and...
Yeah, he's actually a serious painter now. We watched a program the other day. I forget what it was. Maybe it was Comedians in Cars with Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld, and he showed him his paintings and stuff.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I actually like that he's doing that because he's got all the money. Why can't he indulge, like, you know, his...
Well, yeah, but he's kind of gone a little bit alternate with his...
He's loopy, man.
..take on the reality.
Is it all drugs, though, do you think, as well? Like... He must be on a lot of medication, I think, as well, because he's out there.
No, see, I think people like him then naturally, like, their brain chemistry doesn't work the same way ours does. And that's why he was so funny in the day.
Yeah, yeah, true.
I think he's always just been a little bit loopy, and they used to be part of the charm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It gets tired when you get older.
And now he's just a little older and it's kind of changed a little bit, mellowed.
Well, I've heard stories of him with the big beard that he had for a while. Remember, the huge beard? And he was walking around clubs in Hollywood, and there were several actresses and stuff who were on, like, Collider, and one of them said, like, he's an old guy who should be at home. You know? Like, he shouldn't be here. You know what I mean? Like, it's time to go home, Jim. You know? You're not 21.
Yeah. I don't know. I just... A lot of these movies... I don't think they should be revisiting some of this.
I agree.
A massive culture at the moment of reboot and sequel and...
But there is. But
and like, it's all unnecessary.
But, like, it's like when they did the original Independence Day. Loved it. It was a perfect popcorn movie. When they did Independence Day Resurgence, like, 20-plus years later, without Will Smith, it was one of the poorest experiences I've ever had watching a movie.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, how did you go from something that was so good to something that was just so shit?
Yeah.
Like, you rebooted it, but did you really think you had a big chance? Like, without Will Smith, without a good script, with average special effects? Like, what were the chances of that hitting again?
Well, zero chance. Like,
yeah, and it just...
And in hindsight, like, we can all see that there was no chance that movie was going to work.
Yeah.
Yet, they keep persisting with the model.
Yeah, it's funny,
because all of a sudden they're running with Bill and Ted again, and they ran with Ghostbusters, like...
Ted could at least be low budget, so there's not as much to lose, you know? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it could be a low-risk venture, but I'll tell you one thing. They were doing the joke, and they did the Wild Stallions joke, and I must admit, part of me was like, had to remember the joke. It was so long since I'd seen it. It wasn't like the first thing that came to mind. They did the joke, and I had this kind of beat where I was like, what are they doing? And I was like, oh, that's right, guys. I remember that from 1991. Like, it was, you know, that isn't probably the reaction they were hoping for. I wasn't, like, rolling around the ground laughing.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, you've also got Alex Winter, who's the other half of this duo. And
he has done a lot of directing and videos and stuff. Like, he has had a career.
But not in front of the camera.
No. Oh, no. This is all he's got.
He very quickly went behind the camera.
Dude, all he's got is he was in Lost Boys and he was in Bill and Ted in terms of acting.
Yeah.
You know.
So I don't know whether he's going to be... You know, rocking the peak of his acting skills 30 years after that role.
It's an interesting project, I will say that much. Now, Sherlock Holmes 3, Stu, this is what I wanted your opinion on. Robert Downey Jr. And is it Jude Law? Was his Watson?
Yeah.
Now, it's apparently headed to the Old West. Production starts in Jan 2020. As big an RDJ fan as I am, I quite liked both movies. I must admit, I'm not really... you know, craving the third movie, but maybe it will impress me. And I do love RDJ.
I always kind of enjoyed these films, but at the same time, Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock came out at the same time.
Yeah.
Completely different take, and it's so much better. Like, it's a fantastic TV show.
Yeah.
I also hate the idea of it going to the Old West.
Well, that feels very Shanghai Nights to me. Like, it just feels like, let's just insert them. Like, we're once away from going to Japan, you know.
I mean, they've already got the perfect setup where they are. Like, in London in this time period works for that character.
This feels like it's a 1995 idea.
And it really does, doesn't it? Really,
this feels dated. This feels like we're going to do Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles.
This feels like they're a step away from doing a Wild Wild West kind of
movie. None of these things are good, people. This is a sign, I think, when Hollywood sometimes very consciously eats itself. And this is the vibe I'm picking up. I think we're very much, Stu, in a... we're in recycle mode. We're not even calling it reboots. It's just recycle. You know what I mean? Like,
well, having said that, I think this is a good time to have a Sherlock Holmes 3.
Yeah.
Like, we've had 1 and 2 in relative close succession.
Mm. Well, did Guy Ritchie do 1 and 2? Am I right in saying Guy Ritchie did those 2?
I'm not 100% sure that he did 2. He definitely did 1.
Definitely did 1, yeah.
But, yeah, like, it's the same cast, same everything.
Sure.
These actors are still acting.
Yeah, like, big stars.
So I think this is fine to do as a property.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like my biggest problem is just that they're competing. Like, we just had a Sherlock Holmes movie. We literally just had the comedic take on Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes and Watson.
Yeah, it came apparently out a couple of months ago, which was terrible.
I haven't watched it.
We've got the new season of Sherlock from BBC that came out a couple of months ago.
And that's hard to top for the real Sherlock Holmes fans.
If you're a real fan of Sherlock and the novels.
I am of the novels, yeah.
I mean, you're not going to do much better than that, BBC.
I always felt that I love RDJ, but to me they always felt a little sort of like we're doing the kind of shit Hollywood take on Sherlock Holmes in those
movies. Yeah, this is the Hollywood PG take. Yeah.
Like, did you
where it's let's sell this to as many people as possible.
Yeah, did you ever watch the one, it's American as well, Lucy Liu's in it, playing, I think, playing the Watson character?
Oh,
Elementary.
Yeah, Elementary.
Michelle watched all of it. I watched probably about half of it. It wasn't too bad. It wasn't great, but it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, Johnny Lee Miller was a Johnny bit weird. I wasn't a huge...
Yeah, but I know, I'm just saying as a show, like, it wasn't great. I'd give it a 7 out of 10.
But yeah, it kind of worked. It was... I'd probably give it a 6 or something. Like, it's... Yeah. It was a very decent show.
There's a strong concept there, but with Sherlock Holmes, which obviously has been exploited so many times. You know.
We've had a lot of versions of Sherlock, and in the last 5 years, yeah. Like, in a very recent time period.
You're struggling when you're up against... I mean, I'm not being a Cumberbatch's biggest fan, but he certainly knows what he's doing with that character. You know,
I think it's a fantastic... If you haven't seen it, go back and watch it. You can stream the whole thing.
And it's short seasons, too. So you can catch
it's
up.
Like the classic British version. So hour-long hour-long episodes, but there's like 6 episodes or 5 episodes in a season.
So you can catch up. I did it with Luther. You just catch up pretty quickly.
Very quickly,
you know? It's not like American TV, which is like 22 episodes, you know?
No, that American model were 22, 23 half-hour episodes, yeah. Which without adverts is like 22 minutes or something.
Sure.
No, that's a very American model. The British tend to have hour-long shows without ads, but they'll only do 6 to 8 kind of in a season.
Yeah, and it can leave you craving more, for sure, especially with Sherlock, which has had long breaks between seasons at times.
It can do. It gives you the opportunity to run more complicated arcs.
Yeah.
In the 22-minute format, you're limited to how much character growth you can do in one episode.
Well, I mean, a show like Elementary is more like 44 minutes. It's like a 60-minute show with ads, so it's about 40.
So that ran the hour long, yeah, as opposed to the 22-minute.
Yeah, a sitcom sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little different, but still you kind of... I don't know. When they run 20 episodes...
Mm.
You do also get the problem, which is persistent with all these shows, which is they've probably got 10 to 12 episodes of gold.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then they've got another 10 episodes of filler.
Well, yeah, look at a show like that does it so well, Larry David with Curb. He takes pretty much a British model and only does about 10 episodes per season, and they're all gold. There's very few episodes that are weak. I think actually structurally it's a stronger show than Seinfeld. And part of that is scarcity. You know,
absolutely.
He just builds it so nicely and so well that you finish the season, and he always leaves you wanting more, but you're so satisfied with what you got.
Oh yeah, there's a lot to be said for shows like, and look at things like The Flash and the CW network of shows,
which killed.
There are some good episodes, and there are some really good episodes, and then there's half the season, which is who's the bad guy this week,
or romantic twist
pop up. Find a way to beat him, goes to prison, and that's your episode done.
And will they, won't they? You know,
yeah, kiss. For 3 seasons.
That kills me. That kills me after a certain point. Yeah. That gets so tired.
Whereas you condense that into 6 hours of TV over 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you can get some really compelling arcs that move quite quickly.
I remember I used to watch Beverly Hills 90210 for years, and there was a scene in about season 9 where Kelly said to Brandon, "We've approached this romance from every single possible angle." And I was like, "You actually have."
Yeah, when the characters are saying it, you know it's gone too far, right?
I was like, "You actually have. This couldn't have... Nothing is straightforward. Like, we have gone every single route to get you two together and break up and back together, and it to be one person's fault and another person's or someone else's, and like... We've absolved blame multiple times, and we're sort of left going, well, here we are.
Yeah. Like,
we're still talking. It was quite a funny moment of self-awareness for the show, I thought. Yeah, okay. Now, Stu, are you familiar? You're a lot younger than me, Stu. I have no idea who Noah Centineo is, or Centineo. I looked at a picture of him. He's a very handsome young man. He's in talks, apparently very close talks, to play He-Man in Master of the Universe movie. For any people out there who could potentially be on the younger side, he's in a fairly popular rom-com, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, and has a legion of fans. Now, he looks like a very well-built, good-looking guy. Stu, are you familiar with this guy at all? I mean, he's tapped to play He-Man?
No, not really.
No, I've never heard of him in my life, so...
I mean,
but he's got a big fan base, and let's face it, the He-Man franchise is almost, I would say, dead, so they need... If they're going to relaunch it, they need someone, you know, to bring in the people, bring in the punters. I mean,
they're not casting this guy for his name. Like, let's be completely honest. He's just a good looking young guy.
That's it.
That's all they're casting him on. Like, he's got a pretty substantial resume for someone his age.
Mm-hmm.
He's clearly been acting for years.
He's got a lot of followers, too. He actually apparently very popular with, like, that movie, To All the Boys I Loved Before, apparently is a very popular movie, and he's got, like, legions of fans. They're young fans, and primarily female, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, The Fosters is a decently running show that he's been on for quite a bit, so...
What do you think about the He-Man franchise, Stu? Do you think that it can be rebooted and or even just relaunched in just in general? Like, I almost feel like it probably could in this superhero kind of phase.
It's not another question, for sure.
Superhero meets sci-fi was always kind of its appeal.
Yeah, I'd like to see them do it well.
Yeah.
Like, it's a project that I've never really been hot on, just because been a lot of He-Man since I've...
Dude, it's a long way before your time.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, they haven't really rebooted it since I've been around.
As someone who was there, old enough to be there when it was the biggest thing in the world for a few years, and then it just bombed in about 86, 87.
Yeah.
And it just... It went from sort of hero to zero, like, overnight. And yes, they've tried to reboot it several times, and like, I've wanted to get into the comics, but it's never really captured the zeitgeist again since that period.
No.
There's a really fascinating Toys That Made Us episode on He-Man.
Yeah, you've spoken about it before. Yeah, I think
so interesting.
Look, there's potential here. I'm confused as to what audience they're running for. Because typically He-Man's got a male heavy audience.
Yeah, it was always teenage or sort of adolescent boys, basically.
Yet their lead cast makes me kind of think they're looking for a younger, more diverse, more female-centered audience.
That might make sense with the current landscape of today, though.
I think you'd need to change the character to make it more appealing to another demographic. Because the character himself, like, the true-to-form character, has a male-heavy fan base.
Yes, yes.
And definitely. I think part of it's just the way the character's written and the story is an adventure kind of model has always been written more for... Sure. A male audience than a female audience.
It's like boys' own adventure kind of stuff in general, like, you know, in a sci-fi world, basically. You know?
Yeah, and you do see that stereotypically in a lot of sci-fi and fantasy.
Yeah.
You do get more of a male-heavy fan base, but especially when it's a lead, very masculine, hyper-masculine character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's usually called He-Man.
Yeah, exactly right. Like,
by the power of Grayskull.
That's hard to get into if you're a young girl. Like,
yeah, and they very successfully did create She-Ra, who really did phase over with the female market, and they've now got a new She-Ra animated series on Netflix, which is very popular. Noel Stevenson's behind that. So She-Ra was their attempt to capture the girl audience, and they actually managed to do it.
Yeah, so whether they're going to skew this new Masters of the Universe run and not have it so He-Man heavy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's watch your space.
So it makes more sense with that casting choice.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, like, look, the guy's bringing no one in on his name, really, other than these girls who know who he is. But, like, the vast majority of He-Man fans will go, who?
Well, the vast majority of He-Man fans are kind of men in their 40s and 50s.
Yeah, they're people like me. And when, you know, I'm sort of like, we're remaking He-Man? Okay. Live action? Like, you did it terribly in the 80s, but...
Yeah, and when we hear He-Man's going to recast, we're all kind of picturing, like, a buff action hero, you know?
Yeah, sort of like today's Arnie, whoever that would be. Like a bodybuilder, almost, you know?
Yeah, like a John Cena kind of actor, or a Mark Wahlberg kind of actor. Yeah.
But younger than
I. But younger.
People. Yeah.
But someone who's like jacked.
A young John Cena. Imagine John Cena at one point, I don't know when he started his career, but would have been very young, probably would have been a good fit.
Yeah, you
know?
But that's what we're thinking. Like, we're thinking a big, big, buff dude.
This guy's pretty big, though, from what I saw. He looked pretty jacked for a young guy. He looked pretty decently.
I mean, you kind of have to be if you're playing He-Man. Like,
yeah, but
his outfit is Speedos and a couple of belts.
I thought the guy actually, to be fair, I've never heard of the guy. I thought he looked pretty jacked. I was pretty impressed by their casting. I mean, they're skewing. He's like slightly Hispanic or something. And I thought he looked really well built. I actually thought it was not a bad casting choice. Like, personally.
Just
based on looks.
That's the thing. Like, that's all we've got. Like, all I've got to go on is a couple of pictures you get when you Google his name, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know if this is a great choice or what they're going for, but...
Who knows, man. Well, let's even see if it gets made, Stu, because, like...
I mean, technically, it says it's in pre-production, so... Yeah. that doesn't really mean anything in this
There's
day
There's been
age.
Multiple He-Man live-action projects and pre-productions since the original movie. You know, the original film, Stu, you might even have said this, was the first movie to do the end credits scene.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and
with like, the lava pit at the end.
They stole the whole concept of the New Gods from Jack Kirby for the mother boxes and stuff.
Yeah.
And made an appalling movie, by the way.
Yeah, it wasn't good. It but was it broke some ground. There were some famous bits.
It broke some ground.
It was the first to do something. That's an achievement,
now,
I suppose.
Turning to comic news, Stu, Brian Bendis and Alex Maleev are launching the event Leviathan at DC in June. This is the one that has the $10 or $10.99 comics, Stu, the one shot.
I mean, it's a heavy buy-in, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Grant Rucker's doing...
When you're doubling the normal cover price...
Horrific.
You're asking quite a bit from fans.
I think it's only about 40 pages, too. It's not like it's this gigantic novel that they're printing. Like, it's like... I think that's outrageous, personally. But Brian Bendis and Alex Maleev, I mean, two of their biggest stars, obviously, at DC.
Like, you can get away with that for something like... I mean, this week we get the release of Detective 1000.
Sure.
And that's got an inflated cover price. But we're getting 80-odd pages.
You're getting 80-odd pages. I'm getting the hardcover edition coming in. I mean, yeah, whereas Leviathan is just another event from DC.
Yeah, it's a kind of bog-standard event.
And what annoys me as well, for $10, you're not getting... Don't get the impression you're getting a full story. You're going to get the classic, like, we're setting it all up and you go and read all these miniseries.
Yeah, exactly. You're getting like, part one of 43.
Remember when Rebirth came out, which was a decent issue, and Geoff Johns was like, oh, this is going to revolutionize comics. Like, this is going to tell every story ever.
Just
and I was like,
selling it.
No. And when you read it, it was like, wow, you want to read this story and this story and this story? Well, buy here, buy here, buy here, buy here, buy here. You know, it's like, wow, I spent $10 for this, for basically an ad. You know?
I mean, look, we're both on the record for saying that the single comic book is not a long-running format.
No, especially when...
Neither of us can really see a future for these kind of singles.
Long-term. And they're squeezing their audience hardcore. Like, you know, we should actually... I'll speak to Jim at King's Comics and we'll find out how successful this issue's been, like, just at the store level, you know?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming pre-orders will start soon, if they haven't already.
Well, but yeah, they said June, so what are we in now? We're in, late March?
Well, it's still 3 months away. Mm. Like, it's a decent chunk of time. I imagine
rushing down to you to pay you $10?
We'll kind of get an idea in another 2 months.
It'll be like $15 or $16 Australian, I bet.
Yeah, which is roughly the equivalent of Detective 1000.
Yeah.
Like, if you go into a store in Australia and pick that up off the shelves, I think it's $18.
Okay.
For, like, the generic...
Jesus. Yeah, I got the hardcover off Amazon for, want to say, $23 or $24. That's the hardcover, though.
Yeah, see, I pre-ordered my copy through Kings for, I think it's $18 or $17.95 or something.
You're a good man.
Around that.
You're a good man, actually.
So, I mean, that's what they're charging for this as well.
Yeah.
I'd much rather have something like a Detective Comics or an Action Comics 1000.
Totally.
Like a massive landmark.
Do you think you'll put your kids through college on that one, Stu? Is that going to inflate in price so incredibly?
Oh, it's Clown College, maybe?
Clown College.
It's not trusty, a real college.
Trusty the Clown College.
Yeah. It's like a terrible... it's just a cult. It's a cult. It's not even a college.
You pay enough and they give you a little more at the end.
Yeah, this is very dodgy.
DC Stu are seeking a new managing editor for their comics division. Will oversee the schedule, all five of its active publishing lines, DC, Vertigo, Black Label, Ink and Zoom, as well as other projects.
It's odd because they did a reshuffle 6 months ago.
Yeah, this is reshuffling, man.
They're just constantly not quite got the right fit.
Dude, Dan DiDio apparently said that after Batman Damned, they reevaluated everything they did as a company. I was like, really? Like, what an overreaction that was. Like,
and I'll tell you what, for my money, Batman Damned did exactly what it was meant to do.
Yeah,
exactly what it was meant to do.
Still puzzled.
It caused huge levels of controversy.
Yeah,
sales went through the roof.
Yeah,
and by the way, now
it's worth heaps.
It's worth a fortune.
I don't know.
You can't pick that up for less than something like $200. So
I found the whole thing.
That's exactly what they wanted to do with their comics line. They wanted to revamp it to the point where it's now worth buying singles again.
I found that such an odd moral panic. Really, honestly, like I was quite laughable, frankly.
And this isn't the 60s where it wouldn't have been published at all because of the comic book code or anything like that.
A bit of male genitalia.
You could get away with publishing that now. That's not an issue to publish.
Dude, it was the shadow of male genitalia. Was it really that mind-boggling? Like, really, honestly. Like, I get that there was, you know, controversy on the day, but, like, to reevaluate your whole line, cancel the books, like, what an overreaction.
Especially, like, I read this the other day from a scientific journal.
Sure.
So this has been peer-reviewed and everything.
Mm.
They're saying that right now, 100% of children by the age of 13 have viewed pornography.
Yeah. Well, that wouldn't surprise
me. Like, online or whether it's whatever format it's
and
in.
And that wasn't pornography seen in
bad. No, but what I'm saying is, like, that's an audience of 13-year-olds and 100% of them have done that.
Yeah.
Like, have witnessed it at some stage or viewed it or intentionally searched for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're worried that this is going to cause controversy.
Yeah, it was very odd, man.
I imagine the average audience for this book is actually older than 13.
I'd agree, yeah.
It's like they're selling this to five-year-olds.
It was very strange. Like, it's that weird American thing where sometimes they're so hung up on nudity. And yet sometimes so not hung up on nudity. Like, I can think of many shows where there's been full frontal. Like, there was full frontal scenes in, like, American Gods, for example. Like,
The difference is when it's a TV or movie, there's ratings.
Yeah.
Parents and kids all know whether they're allowed to see that rating or
not. But was Batman Damned sold sealed before the controversy broke? Because certainly it was sold sealed.
I think it was meant to be, but there's no actual real restrictions. Like, you can still walk into a comic book store as a kid and say, I want to buy Batman.
As saying it's really not the worst thing in the world. It's like topless women. Like, I mean, I don't know why people get in this fucking thing where, like, oh my God, like, stop the internet. You know what I mean? Like, really? Like, there's a part of me...
For me, it wasn't... It wasn't aggressive in any way. It wasn't violent or...
It was a shadow.
It was a perfectly normal kind of image.
Yeah, I mean, so, I thought it was funny that they broke up as a controversy, but I was really surprised that Dan and Dio saying they reevaluated everything they're doing. They pulled the other Batman Damned. How has Brian Azzarello taken this? Like, he was writing Dark Knight Master Race with Frank Miller. He was, you know, he's an accomplished writer, like 100 Bullets. He's done a lot of work with DC. How's he taken this? Like,
I'll tell you what, if they give the job to me, I'm finishing off this Batman Damned run. I'm publishing another 5 comics. I'm finishing that 6 issue.
Well, I don't know if that will ever get published like that. Should
they? Well, that's what I'm. If they hire me, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm building my platform on.
Fair enough.
I'm putting that out there.
Yeah, it's just odd.
That's my election promise.
Now, we had a discussion of Darth Bane. I confirmed Darth Bane, who came back from the dead, basically. His only on-screen appearance happened as a ghost to Jedi Master Yoda in the animated series Star Wars. It was voiced by Mark Hamill, and Darth Bane was a Sith Lord back in the dawn of, like, the Old Republic, Stu. So he did come back as a Sith ghost and spoke to Yoda, which is in canon, because it was in Clone Wars, and it's considered in canon, so that was a question that came up on an earlier show. So I did a bit of research. So, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that the chances of, like, a Palpatine Force ghost is possible, I guess, because in canon it's happened before.
I mean, yeah, it's not out of the question, but it's just, why would they need to?
Yeah, who knows? I'm so tired of hearing it as a rumor that I'm just now like, can I just watch the movie and then I'll fucking see what they do? Like, I just don't care that much. I'd like to see it, but I'm also not going to make out like it's the only reason I'm watching episode 9. Like, it would be cool to see, but so would a lot of other things, you know? I don't know.
Like, for me, if you're going to make a movie, you've got to be able to justify the decisions that you make.
Well, I think they're saying...
And I think they've made a few movies recently, Star Wars especially, that have made very questionable decisions when editing and when shooting.
Mm-hmm.
That they've kind of put in scenes that...
You're referencing Solo and Last Jedi specifically, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah.
That they've made active choices that have gone against the character...
Yeah.
Have gone against what the fan base knows the character as, which is always dangerous.
Or even in Solo, I'd just say weak choices that were just not particularly compelling, even. Not even that controversial, just kind of like, very predictable.
But that's what I mean. Like, if you're going to make a decision, justify it.
Yeah.
Have the story need it or reference it and make it a tight film.
I do that, Stu, when I make my points on the signal, I justify them. You don't always like it, but I do it. I justify it.
Your version of justification and mine are very different. Your version is, if I talk about it enough for long enough, eventually I'll outlast my opponent.
Wear it down. The old rope-a-dope tactics. The old rope-a-dope tactics.
I've often called you a rope-a-dope. That's
rumble in the jungle. Tommy Cavell wrote it with some high praise for the show, Stu, and also yourself. I mean, he's got this huge thing because you're a teacher. I mean, and he's a teacher. I mean, you two are just like blood brothers because you're teachers.
Well, we're good people. We're good people.
I will say, Stu is a good teacher and all that, so he deserves some plaudits. But I got some plaudits from Tommy, who thought I worked in HR, was a HR manager. And this, for me, has been gold all week. I've been saying to Michelle all week that I actually spoke to the HR guy at work and said, can I sit in with you, man, because people are talking about
it. I remember you having that conversation. And
he said yes. He said, yes, you can.
In a fit of laughter. He was laughing while saying yes.
Have you ever seen...
It was the most hilarious joke you'd ever come up with.
Dragon Age Inquisition, where the king sits in his throne, you're the king, and people come up to you and petition, you have to make decisions. That's how I'm picturing myself in HR. Literally sitting on my throne, kind of scratching my beard, they come up, I go, I'll allow it, or no, off with his head. Like, I'll make very snap decisions. I'm going to be fast.
I feel like you're the HR guy that immediately gets fired for HR breaches. Like,
I'll be handling the complaints as well, so, you know, that's a positive. Finally in charge of the complaints.
Once again, your idea of positive and mine are very different things. Borderline illegal, actually, what it sounds
Tommy
like.
Tommy said we had a very solid show where perfect foils. I mean, I don't know if I called you perfect, but, like, he tries hard. And
I definitely call you a foil. So
I don't even quite know what that means. It's like straight man and funny guy, yeah? I mean, I'm definitely the funny guy, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. And I do mean funny, as in, like, I'm hilarious. Like, you know, like, I'm surprised listeners can control themselves with the laughter that must be coming out.
It's funny, but it's like special funny. Like,
Stuart, I don't think you can say that anymore. I'm going to put you up there. My HR cut. I don't think you can say that anymore, dude. I think that's un-PC or something these days to say that.
Well, what was I referring to, Dad? When I said that's special right. funny,
I don't know, man. But like,
what was I referring
to? I'm in HR now, and I'm pulling out all sorts of fucking red cards, man.
Except you're not in HR. Except you're not in HR. That's
well, according to Tommy Cavell, I am. Anyway, thank you, Tommy, for writing in, and thank you, because I must admit, all week long, I've been saying to Michelle, can you see me in HR? And she's like, no, I can't. Like, I'm like, well, I can. Like,
I can't.
But I just get a feeling it's not as well paid, and that's really a turn-off for me. And, like, I was trying to kind of snoop in, like, so what kind of package are we looking at, like, you know, if I got involved? And I think he's like, whoa, dial down, big guy. And I'm like, I want to start at the top, man. I feel like I'm ready to roll, and people are talking, you know.
I honestly wonder about your grasp on reality.
Like,
sometimes.
Put me into the big fucking complaints. I want to be in the room when the real shit's going down, and I have to make some big calls. You know, like instinctual, like operate on instinct. Like, I'd say this: get the rule book, throw it out the fucking room. I don't even want to hear about rules. I'll make the calls.
I'm surprised you're not throwing the rule book at the head of the employee to teach them a lesson.
Yeah, there'd be a bit of that. Bit of tough love.
Snitches get stitches. That's what you're coming out with.
Yeah. You're talking, but you ain't walking.
Not ever again, pull out the sledgehammer. Like, I feel like you're just going to go back to, like, 40s-style gangster tactics here.
Sure, you're probably not wrong there. And maybe that's what this world needs. Maybe that's what this millennials
need. Maybe. I doubt it. I heavily doubt it.
Maybe that's what these millennials need, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, they come in with their fucking avocado sandwich and, you know, I've got to lay it on the line.
I love a good avocado sandwich.
Of course you do, Stu. And that's half the problem.
Avocado is delicious. You can't call someone a millennial because they enjoy avocado.
But that's half the problem.
That's ridiculous. I don't mind
a little bit of avocado.
Oh, then clearly you're a millennial, Dave, by your own argument.
You are a millennial, aren't you? Are you a millennial?
I don't know. I don't want to be if I am.
Were you born in the 80s?
I was, technically. Born in the 80s.
I think that makes you one. I'm not sure. I don't know the exact rules.
I don't know. The cutoff has changed so many different times.
Yeah. Well, not for me.
And it doesn't really fit. Like,
no. I mean,
I was basically brought up as Gen X.
If I had to pigeonhole you, and I enjoy doing that. I'd say you're a whiny Gen X. Like, you're not like a tough, cynical Gen X like me. You're kind of the whiny version, like the last.
Oh, thank
one.
You, thank you, Dave. That's high praise coming from the whiny Gen Y.
No, I'm Gen X.
Or are you a whiny baby boomer?
No, Gen Y is younger, so Gen X is older. Gen X is my generation, like people born around the mid-70s.
But you act like you were born in the mid-40s.
Yeah, baby boomer. Yeah, that's what I really wanted.
You're not even a baby boomer. You're pre-baby boomer. What was the generation before baby boomers?
I don't know, just old.
But I feel like that's where you fit.
Well, baby boomers are all born, like, directly post-war, basically, after Civil War.
Yeah, you'd kind of say 1950 onwards, kind of.
Oh, 1945 onwards. I think it's right after the war, when all the soldiers came back, basically.
Yeah,
for a few days.
Roughly.
I mean, and people are like, what do I... Tick, do I like Frank Sinatra? Yes. Do I like hot tea? Yes. Do I like blankets over my head? Yes. You know, all these things.
Do you complain about young people constantly? Yes. Yes,
definitely.
Do you have phantom pains that you whinge about? Yes. Do you have views that have long since changed in the zeitgeist? Yeah, definitely.
I don't know about that. Sure, I like to consider myself pretty cutting edge. Oof, anyway, weekly comments.
Either of those two words.
Okay, Savage Sword of Conan 3. Jerry Duggan and Ron Garney on art. This was a better issue than the previous one, which we really didn't like. To me, this is still very much paint by the numbers, Conan. I gave it a 6.5 out of 10. I still would be recommending the Jason Aaron series over it.
Absolutely. 100% agree with that. Yeah. I think this is definitely a weaker Conan.
It's a shame, because I like Jerry Duggan in general. But I actually got to say, I found Ron Garney's art was quite sort of sketchy. I love Ron Garney in general, but I didn't think his art was A+ on this issue. It was very sort of like sketchy and loose, is how I would describe it.
I actually found this book. I started reading it, and then I flipped the page, and I was done. And I kind of went, "Oh, okay, that's all the story I'm getting this week, huh?" Okay,
it was an underwhelming issue.
It was certainly quick to read. Like, I can't tell if I just lapsed into a coma for 15 minutes while I read it, or...
I'm surprised you gave 15 minutes.
But...
What did you give it? I gave it 6.5.
I gave it a 5.5.
Yeah.
I'm...
Yeah, it's not the worst thing you'll ever read, but it's certainly...
It's readable. Yeah. If this becomes a good collection, I could understand this being part of it, but...
Well...
I wouldn't be recommending people go out and pay for this single.
I can tell you Jerry Duggan's on there for a 5-issue series, and then they're bringing someone else on. So,
3 of 5, this should be right in the meat of the story.
Yeah.
And it felt like nothing happened.
To me, this just felt like a very generic Conan story with quite good art from Ron Garney, who I generally like, but I didn't even feel Ron Garney was probably given a lot to work with. The story felt very loose to me. Interestingly enough, the second comic we had this week was Avengers No Road Home number 6, which introduced Scarlet Witch meeting Conan in regular Hyboria. I loved this issue. I thought the art was fantastic. I thought the stuff happening with the other Avengers was great, with the Hulk and Hawkeye. But just Conan and Scarlet Witch's relationship, I actually thought this was one of the most... I made a note here. I really thought it was one of my favourite Avengers comics I've read in years, as well as an excellent Conan kind of single issue as well. I really enjoyed this issue.
I took this the complete opposite way. I've been mostly enjoying the No Road Home run.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've read the first 5 issues.
Oh, had you? See, I hadn't at all.
Right, okay. So, I mean, effectively, at the end of issue 5, Scarlet Witch just gets put in a portal and teleported to this new realm, and she doesn't know where she's gone.
She meets Conan at the end of the issue, isn't that how 5 ends?
Effectively, yeah. She kind of wakes up and Conan's standing there. Mm-hmm. And then this just felt like Marvel playing the game of, where else can we put Conan? It felt honestly like this was the most shoehorned character.
They are playing that game. I mean, they're definitely making the most.
That's exactly right. Like, that's what I feel like. They've just gone, how many titles can we fit Conan into?
Well, I think it's good.
And I'll bet you we can do one more than whatever you're thinking.
But what I like about it is, though, there would be Avengers diehards out there who aren't picking Conan up. I thought this was actually a pretty good Conan issue. Like, this was pretty much Conan with a witch. Like a fellow traveller. That's a lot of Conan stories. Like, going through the desert with a fellow traveller, etc., etc. To be honest, I really enjoyed it and thought the art was really good. Just as kind of a one and done, I could pick up the basic beats of the story from what was going on from the description and stuff, and I've kind of half kept in touch with it. But, I don't know, for me, it worked as a Conan Scarlet Witch issue, but I also liked the beats of the other Avengers, like the Hulk and all that, talking and stuff. I actually found it quite fascinating.
This run, the No Road Home, started more or less the same way Jason Aaron's Thor run started.
Okay.
Where there was kind of a massacre of a bunch of gods.
Okay.
And in this case...
Olympus, yeah?
Yeah, Olympus. Hercules kind of gets this message that his entire family's been wiped out.
Uh-oh.
And it was... you kind of meet the villain and meet her children and offspring that's causing all this mayhem.
Mm-hmm.
And it started off like a really cool story. Like, I was expecting like a god butcher, a kind of story,
mm-hmm.
similar to the Thor that we both loved.
Mm.
And they kind of ended up throwing a quest in the middle of it because this is a 10-issue story, which I feel like is a little too long.
It's a little long. They're trying to do what they did with the other one we read all the way through, the one with Voyager.
Yeah, well, I mean, Voyager's back in this one.
Yeah, and it's the same creative team. Like, Jim Zub's involved.
Yeah, exactly right. I feel like this is a 6-issue story.
Yes.
Told over 10 again.
Agree.
So they've thrown in these little mini quests in the middle of it.
And this was very much
a mini there's a shard quest. That's been thrown into another dimension.
Yeah.
And let's just send Scarlet Witch diving into that dimension to get it. And
it's
then
very video gamey.
You wake up and Conan's there, and he'll be there for the next episode, and then she'll either find a way back, and Conan will come with her. And
who is Scarlet Witch with in the comics? When she said, "Oh, there's someone back home," was she referencing Vision, or was she referencing someone else, like romantically? You know, when she almost kissed Conan, and Conan then referenced Bolit, from the Pirate Queen, who had died obviously quite recently. In the
continent. Yeah, no, Scarlet Witch was referencing Vision.
Okay. I got to be honest, I really enjoy this issue. It came with a bit of praise on a couple of sites I'd read, and I just read it thinking, well, let's see what Marvel do. Personally, I gave it 8.5. I found it very compelling. Where were you?
I only gave it a 7, but I feel like this is actually one of the weaker runs of the 6
okay.
Avengers titles.
I might even go back and read some of the other stuff, or maybe I'll read the next issue, because I did enjoy it.
Like, it's not a bad event. I think there have been way worse events. Oh. It's not a classic. It's not a buy and hardcover immediately, kids.
Oh, no, kids. This ain't a classic. This is very kind of run-of-the-mill.
But it's very readable. It's very readable Avengers.
I mean, I take this over fucking Secret Empire, you know?
Yeah.
But no, it's not a classic. This is video game comics. Like, there's a shard that's got the multiple dimensions to chase the shard down. You know,
yeah, effectively.
Yeah, which is pretty much what it is.
Yeah, it's a paint-by-numbers story told with interesting characters.
I've got to say this as well. I want to pay some attention to the art. I love the art. I actually love the way they did Conan's world mixed with the Scarlet Witch. And I didn't at first think I would love it. I was kind of like one of those people, a bit old-fashioned. Like, but then I thought, you know what? Give it a try. Like, who cares? Like, you know, really. Like, I sort of had that attitude. Like, Scarlet Witch is in Conan's world. I can buy into it. Like, I've read a lot more bizarre comics than that. Like, Grant Morrison's in fucking Animal Man and answers the door as Grant Morrison. Do you know what I mean? Like, comics can get a little bit wacky.
Yeah.
Spider-Man City at War, which is the release by the game, I'll be honest, I gave it 6 out of 10. Art's fine. I didn't find this even slightly entertaining. I really thought this. Sometimes Spider-Man, to me, the way they do it these days, I sometimes think, man, is it me or is it just getting more fucking dull? I found this quite a dull issue of Spider-Man. Where were you, man? I don't know. I just a lot of setup,
I actually quite enjoyed the concept. This is one of those concepts that I feel like Marvel's trying with this,
sure,
to do something different to start boosting sales.
Yeah.
So obviously we had the Spider-Man PS4 game.
Yeah, it was huge
success worldwide.
One of the games of the year.
Yeah, and this is the comic book series based on the game.
Yes.
So it's an entirely separate universe, the Gamerverse. Mm-hmm. It's the first title they are launching other titles. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of a different take on Spidey, where there's a younger Aunt May. Doc Ock's just a friendly, nice guy now.
But, yeah. But is it that different, though? You know, really?
No. I mean, Peter Parker's been redone 100 times. Like, yeah. We've seen new Spider-Man every couple of years. This isn't a new concept at all.
Yeah. I just thought it would be a bit better, because I think the game got such good reviews. I don't know, this was one where I was like, you know what, Dave, probably just not your cup of tea. Art's very nice. I just felt there was a lot of setup, and not much was interesting was happening.
Look, there are, but this, remembering that this whole series is meant to be paying off people that have played the video game. Yeah. This is to give them the kind of bits of story between the moments in the video game.
Good point.
Giving them the origins of the character before you start playing, and then setting up where all the characters are so you can play the game and kind of get the whole experience. So,
you know what? Maybe that is a good idea.
I think there is a whole nother level of gratification that we're not getting, because neither of us play the game.
I'd love to have played the game, but it wasn't on Xbox or Xbox One. I wonder how the sales are on it. I should ask Jim. Like, because a lot of people bought that game. I wonder how many people are picking up the comic. You know?
I'll tell you this once again. Feels like another opportunity missed. If they'd released this in line with the game.
Thank you.
And in fact, given people a copy inside the cover of the game.
Thank you, Stuart. Yes.
Here's issue one of a brand new universe. Yeah. You need zero reading experience to pick this up and go from to anything.
So agree with you, Stuart. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, 100,000 people worldwide who bought the game.
Otherwise, they've got to walk into a comic store like King's and work out where Spider-Man is and work out that City at War is the Spider-Man game release, you know, sync title. Whereas if you just said it, put it in the, like, they've done things like this before. Like, I can tell you, when I bought my Hellboy
DVD back in the day of the movie.
Yep.
They included a Hellboy comic, and same with V for Vendetta. And the first Hellboy I ever read was the comic that came with the DVD.
Yeah.
You know what? I read it and went, actually, you know what? This ain't bad.
Yeah.
That was literally my reaction. And V for Vendetta had, which is a very famous comic in its own right.
Yes, it is.
Had the comic included with the special edition I bought. And once again, I read it and went, wow, this is actually a really interesting, you know.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you're kind of, if you're brand new to the comic industry,
yeah,
you're kind of Googling where the next store is.
Exactly.
But if you're someone like us, you go in there and you intentionally go to a different section of that store.
Exactly.
And you just have a look and browse that area.
I walked by Hellboy Comics for 10 years. And I'd heard everyone say Hellboy was good, and I just hadn't paid any attention. And then I went and saw the movie and went, I quite like this. Picked up the DVD, had a comic, read it, and went, shit, this comic's actually good.
Yeah.
So, and it didn't take that extra step. I wish they were smart enough to do that, Stu.
It feels like a massive opportunity missed, doesn't it?
I agree with you. And there's nothing, like, even though I gave it 6 out of 10, there's nothing wrong with this comic, and I think players of the game would get a lot out of it.
Yeah, and look, I gave it a 6.5. I think it's bang on average.
Yeah.
But I think for someone that's never read a comic book...
Sure.
If you've played the game, I think this is a fantastic way to start.
Yeah, agree.
Because it's literally the first comic in an entire universe.
They've got to start getting more clever, Stu. They've got to start including these kind of things if they're serious.
And this is different divisions of the same company that are so fractured and not talking to each other that they're kind of missing out on this synergy, which helps everybody, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'll tell you what, there's a bunch of comic book readers that are reading this and going, oh, this is linked in with the game. Maybe I should get the game.
And don't forget, everyone that walks into a store, like if you walk into like a King's Comics or whatever, and you become a regular comic book reader, you're probably bringing in about $1,200 to $1,500 per year, maybe, in terms of what you'll spend, potentially. You know, in terms of merch, comics.
It massively depends on the individual.
But what I'm saying is, the second that they start becoming a buyer, there's a certain level of monetary value attached to them. You know?
Not necessarily. Like,
you think? Well, you know, well, a regular buyer who starts coming in and buying comics, there's going to be an amount they're going to spend. There's a dollar sign over their fucking head.
Sure, but if you're showing up literally every week to buy the same title, you're looking at $250 a year.
Oh, it floats around, but I reckon...
Like, that's reckon pretty comics- low, whereas if you're a professional, you've got a solid career, you don't have massive expenses or family or whatever else...
Yeah.
You could very easily spend $5,000 in a year.
If you're a lone gunman, if you're Frank Castle like me, you know, you'll do what you do.
Yeah, making little sneaky purchases of omnibuses and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, like,
all sorts of crazy shit.
Like, it depends massively on the individual, though. Like, some people can't afford to spend more than $100 a year, and that's what they do, though.
Of course. Oh, dude, there's no shame. Like, when I was in uni and when I was in high school, I've told you, my budget was I could buy 2000 AD weekly. It was about $1 to $1.50 in the time I was buying it, and I could buy Punisher, and that was my budget. Like, because I had no extra money, but I could just afford that. So yeah, there's no shame in like having a lower budget and just spending what you can. I mean, that's life. Now, a couple of collections I want to just shout out this week. There's a Savage Sword of Conan on one of us collecting the first volume of the really classic black and white run. I've got that one order. And secondly, Stu, this is one I thought you might be interested in. Iron Man by Fraction and LaCora, or LaCara, I'm sure how you say his name.
LaRocca,
yeah.
Have you tried reading?
The Complete Collection, Volume 1. Now, Stu, I can swear by how good Matt Fraction's Iron Man run is.
I already got it. I have it in hardcover. Okay. I love it.
It's a great run, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's for listeners as well. I want listeners to know that there's...
On the other thing, obviously, we've mentioned it before, Detective Comics 1000 comes out this week. Go and pick up a copy if you're...
Oh, yes. That comes out, so that'll come out Wednesday in the States after the show releases and Thursday in Australia.
So it's out this week.
Yes.
So if you're interested, pick up a copy, go and pre-order it now.
Yes. And we will discuss it on the show.
Yes, but it's a big issue. It's an 80-pager.
80-pager.
So.
Buckling kids. Isn't that right, Stu? Is it going to revolutionise comics as I know it?
Maybe.
Let's hope.
Maybe if you have a brain aneurysm or something.
I was just saying the other day, is that in poor taste when we've already had Amelia Clark's had 2 brain aneurysms? As a HR director, I'm not sure if I can allow that comment, Stu.
In that case, I'm totally fine because you're not an HR director.
Do you like the new PC HR Dave?
I prefer him to the outlandishly racist Dave that pops up every now and again.
I take offense to this.
Oh, no, every now and again. You say something and you just kind of go, Ooh, that's...
Stu, nothing makes you sound more like a millennial than you trying to play the PC card. It's quite hilarious, frankly.
Hang on. Like, you literally just finished playing the PC card.
No, but what
that's the most hypocritical complaint I've ever heard.
I do it ironically, Stu, because I really believe it's worthless. So I do it ironically.
Hence making my argument and making you a hypocrite again. This is...
Okay. Anyway, I think we've covered new releases. That'll be the end of fucking new releases with that distasteful discourse from you. This week, Stuart, we are doing, and I forgot to mention at the top of the show.
Yeah, I know.
And frankly, once again, you've let the team down. Frankly, though,
you've let yourself down. You've let the signal down.
This is on you, though, because you didn't remind me. You didn't remind me.
It is written at the top of the show notes.
Part of your job
is scroll up, Dave, and have a look at your phone.
No.
It's written Judge in it. I can't do any more than write
Judge
it down.
Judge Reynolds, you could do more. You could do more by reminding me at the start of the show.
I did. I wrote it at the top of the page.
I forgot. Well, you know what? We got distracted as we fought about IG 88. That distracted me.
It's not my fault.
Well, I think partially your fault. I think we can agree that I would say 40-60.
No.
Anyway, Judge Reynolds, Stu. Big read, was about 25, 26 parts, obviously shorter volume, to give listeners the story. Set in the Judge Red World of Mega City 1, Chopper is in a couple of previous Judge Red stories and famously wins Super Surfer, sky surfing race with basically hover surfboards, Stu, would you say? And he won that Super Surf 7, got jailed by Dredd at the end. He gets busted out to race in Super Surf, I think it's 10.
10, yeah.
Which is held in Sydney, Australia.
After Chopper won 8 and 9. Sorry, after...
Chopper won 7, yeah. And he was in prison for 8 and 9. And
no, but who's his competition? Who's the...
Jug McKenzie?
Yeah, Jug. Yeah, Jug won 8 and 9 while he was in.
And so basically, there's two storylines here in Oz. The primary story, it's really a Chopper story. Chopper is the star of this story. It's him flying on the board from Mega City 1 all the way to Oz and competing in the race. The secondary...
Yeah, through, nuclear wasteland apocalypse stuff.
Over the cursed Earth, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, originally, he just flies off and Dredd goes, there's no point chasing him. He's not going to survive that. He's just ridden off to his own death. So, thanks, buddy.
But then the secondary story, which actually has a lot of import in the 2000 AD mythos, is the story of the Judder, who basically an offshoot of imperfect clones that then storm into Mega City 1 and are trying to sort of disrupt things there. And that becomes a huge story in later 2000 AD.
Imperfect clones of the Judges, though.
Yes. Fargo... has different, like Dredd is a clone of Judge Fargo and several other judges are clones of different people. But Judd was like a mad geneticist who wanted to clone the citizens. And he got forced out of his position and it basically went and hid out in Ayers Rock, in Uluru. And that's kind of the secondary story in this. And it gets a few episodes quite heavy. I remember reading as a kid, because my very first 2000 AD I picked up was one of these issues, very early on in the Chopper storyline. They blew my mind as a kid with the McCarthy Yard, and it was a pleasure to revisit them. And that later becomes a huge part of the 2000 AD mythos, because one of them becomes like one of the big judges. But look, that's overall the pitch of the storyline. I love it. Chopper, I thought, was an interesting one to pick for you, Stu, because I knew you weren't too hot on Dredd in Apocalypse War. But in this storyline, you've got a more humanized character as Chopper. What did you think?
This was actually the worst book I've ever read.
Really?
Yeah. This was worse than Time and Tide. This was...
Really?
This is actually the worst book I have ever read.
Wow.
I found the writing horrendously bad.
Really? John Wagner and Alan Grant?
Horrendously bad.
Wow.
The Australian characters are written...
Oh, the Australian characters.
Awful.
The Australian stuff is very satirical.
Awful.
Yeah.
I think they're kind of claiming it's satire once they knew it bombed heavily. At the time, it was just poorly written. Since, they've kind of gone, oh, no, it was satire.
It was satire.
To kind of cover up what they did.
They use satire on the Brits judges themselves. They're famous for doing that. Like,
there's satire and then there's just poor writing. And this is... Okay. Throw every Aussie slang that's ever been in a TV show.
We might get like a balanced Judge Red review from you, but clearly we're not getting one. We're getting
I wish I could. I read the whole thing, which was more than 200, by the way. So
not much more.
It was, and I still read the whole thing, cover to cover.
Wow, so I have such a
and
different opinion.
My God, this was actually the worst thing I've ever read.
Really?
I struggled so many times.
What was the... Because I thought you might like it because I thought Chopper was the lead hero. I couldn't love it,
stand Chopper.
Didn't like him?
No.
He's just a little punk rebel, you know.
It was written so poorly.
Okay.
Well, like, honestly, this is as close as you can get to out-and-out racism of Australians.
Oh, it's not. Sure
you can, Dave. And don't try to play the... Oh, Dave, he's playing the PC card again. Well, this is as close as you can get without it actually being considered racist.
Let's look at it in the time it was written, okay?
It doesn't matter what time it is,
yes,
Dave.
Yes, it does. Context is everything in these things. Like this was written around the time of Crocodile Dundee, for example.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And they're definitely...
Put it this way, it makes Crocodile Dundee look very clever and sophisticated.
But
which is saying a lot, because that's...
I wouldn't even say, though, like, other than a few, like, Struths and all that kind of stuff, I don't even think the Oz people are a big part of the storyline. The biggest star of this story is Chopper.
Yeah, who's 100%. Just terribly...
I love Chopper. Like, okay, well, I'm not surprised Stuart has a negative...
Put it this way, I can understand people enjoying this, but I get that it's largely nostalgia.
Mm.
I think if you were reading this for the very first time, it'd be a very different take.
What did you think of the Judder? I loved it. I mean, I haven't read it for probably 15 years, and I came back to it, for me, yes, as nostalgia, but I still think it holds up as a story. I don't consider it the greatest of the story, but I do enjoy it. The reason I picked it, really, was because Judge Dredd is very much a side character in the story, and I wanted you to kind of experience more the sort of, like, I thought maybe putting in a more humanized character as Chopper. Chopper is basically a rebel-free spirit who always struggles against the confines.
The problem is he's not written as a human. He's written as a caricature of a human.
Mm.
Everything's blown up to this extreme level where you've lost that human element, so you don't get the humanizing experience that you'd...
Judge Dredd...
kind of hopeful.
Judge Dredd... I mean, I think Alan Grant...
Judge Dredd, you're not expecting that.
Yeah.
Like, you read Judge Dredd and you're not expecting to feel emotion and empathy for Judge Dredd.
No.
Like, that's not the character.
He's old stony face.
But in this case, you're writing about, you know, human citizens.
Mm.
And you still don't get it.
Well...
It's still not written that way.
It's so funny because for me reading it, it was very much like looking back through sort of photographs or letters of, like, a first love. Like,
yeah, exactly. You got that nostalgia because, you know, it's not your first time reading it. So no, you've kind of...
It's pretty much probably my third. I really haven't read it much since it came out. Like, I mean, it was my first 2008. So there is definitely nostalgia. But I will say this, and I have read a lot of 2008 before it and after it. Alan Grant and
You said this was your first, right?
Oh, no, but I mean, I've read...
You've read around it since then.
Yes, Since I picked up that first issue of 2008, I read a lot of the 2008 that came before this.
Yeah.
And I read quite a bit after it because I collected it for about 5 or 6 years after this. A good 5 or 6 years of weekly comics, so you've got a lot of reading. I mean, I thought this was the last time that Wagner and Grant worked together. This was the end of their professional partnership. They basically wrote a ton of Judge Dredd from, like, you know, 80 to, like, 89 or 88, whatever it was. Stack of stuff together and other titles. This was the end of their professional partnership in terms of the weekly title. They actually went their own ways. They had a bit of difference of opinion on certain things.
This doesn't necessarily read like the partnership's breaking up.
Mm.
Like, I can't tell by reading this that there's two people at odds.
Apparently,
it is quite a consistent story, but
yeah,
I just don't think the consistency is a good thing. Apparently,
the reason for the partnership... And I think it was a relatively amicable breakup, too. Like, I mean, they did other projects since, but I think it was just they realised they're probably different, going different ways. Like, Alan Grant was very keen on the comedy element and the satire that was always a big part of 2000 and Judge Dredd, whereas Wagner was more into sort of like the darker procedural police take, which it very much has become since. Pretty much I haven't been reading it, but he's taken it that way a lot more since. So they had different approaches, and I think this was the final where they went, you know what? We did this for half a year, because it was about a half a year through the comics, 26 weeks. And then they sort of said, let's go our separate ways. And, you know, they sort of looked at their characters and go, you can take this one, and Wagner will take Dredd, and he'll take Stronium Dog, and et cetera, et cetera. I hear what you're saying. Like, I thought reading this would be a thinner experience. And in some ways it was. But I still was pumped up for that race. Like, I remember as one thing I wanted to bring up on the show is, I remember as a kid, like, it all builds towards the final race, okay, which it's a long build, 20 issues, I think, and then the race is about 4 issues. And it comes down to, like, their race down that final straight against each other. And I remember being in the not even the comic strip, it was in the newsagent. And I was so desperate to read it that I read it before I even bought it. And it gets to, spoilers, Jug McKenzie winning. And I was like, still get chills. Because I was so disappointed. You know what I mean? Like, but I thought it was, in a weird way, I kind of took it on the chin. At the time I thought, like, man, they built this story up. Like, it was a very kind of noble loss. But they sucked me in. Like, this was my first experience of reading, like, 2018. I've been reading it for, like, 20 weeks. I picked it up. It's probably about the third issue of the series when I picked it up originally. So I've been reading solidly, and I was like, I remember being like, man, Chopper didn't win. Like, but I remember also thinking, like, well, they don't always have to win. You know, like, but I thought it was a good, what did you think of that choice? That's actually something I wanted to discuss with you. Like, what did you think of that choice?
I liked that they didn't go with the obvious.
Yeah.
I liked they didn't go with the hero winning in the end of the day. Yeah. And everything works out nicely.
And Chopper was very much the hero.
Yeah, he was. He was always painted as the hero. I just felt like it was too small a twist after 26 or 24 issues.
Sure.
Like, if they'd made that twist after 8 or 9 issues and we'd had the race relatively quickly,
yeah,
and then got into a separate story about the Judder and all that sort of, this just felt like a drag.
And I don't disagree with you there. I at times reading it at the time, because I wasn't an unintelligent reader. Like, at the time, I was pretty new to comics.
And you'd notice it more reading it weekly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, in a collected, well, like, you and I both read a collected edition.
And it reads pretty fast.
Yeah, well, and like you said, they're short issues.
Mm.
But you do have a lot of issues.
Yeah.
And it does take almost 200 pages to go from him getting broken out from prison saying, I'm going to be in that race.
Yes.
And 200 pages later, he finally gets to the race.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, did it really take that long to get there with a whole bunch of almost nothing in the middle?
Well, they, at the time, I remember being like, oh man, a Judder issue. Cause like I was so fascinated by what was going on with Chopper.
Yeah.
But, and I think they got the heat at the time. I think some of the stuff we're saying, they were getting at the time too. Cause people were very invested in Chopper. And the Judder stuff, like when it comes in for a good 3 or 4 issues.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, I think it's also a chance for the Dread fans to get a bit of Dread. Because Red was very much a backseat character most of the time here. He's just kind of hovering on the sidelines, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he's barely in the first, like, 6 or 7 issues.
Which is very unlike Judge Red Comics. Judge Red Comics, he's in pretty much every scene, generally.
Yeah.
You know. Look, I think they made a lot of... I think this was probably a big turning point for 2008. They were actually having a very successful line. Like, they were starting to crest here. This is where Morrison was on the title. They had Peter Milligan. They had Wagner and Grant. Like, they were very popular. And I think this was a bit of a bold experiment at the time to do such a long-running series without Judge Dredd being the hero. Chopper was a popular character because he'd been in 2 previous stories that were very popular. I love its experimentation. I hear what you're saying. Like, it didn't hit for you. I'm not even that surprised.
I mean, this reads very much like it's a book written for an American audience, I read.
Sure.
Because of the way they've written the Australian character.
Sure. I mean, were you that worried by that, though? Because I thought that was just kind of funny, you know?
Immediately, like, when you... literally, the first speech bubble...
Sure.
...is the most over-the-top Australian kind of...
But I think that was just the joke, man. Like, they do Irish... Because remember, it's Brits writing it. They're not Americans writing it.
No, I know. But I think it was still written for an American as opposed to a British audience.
Maybe it was. That would be interesting to know. Because maybe they were trying to break... They were definitely trying to break in the American market in the 80s. Like when they wrote the Brits, for example, like,
yeah,
well, they wrote Brits, they did them as kind of like stereotypical British. And when they did the Irish, they did Garth Ennis is Irish and he wrote Judge Dredd. He did very stereotypical Irish. I think 2008's humor at the time was very much on the nose humor. Like that wasn't out of, like, to be honest, that wasn't even as an Australian. I mean, I saw that as just a bit of a joke. Like they did that stuff all the time.
But like, if you wanted to make that joke and that's totally fine to do, you kind of have one character who's so over the top.
Sure. But it was every
Ocker Australian.
Every Aussie
that, that is the walking joke, and the others are all kind of a moderated version of an Australian.
Yeah.
And you kind of get the joke. Like, that is how you...
I know, but I think...
Put it in there. But when every character is so over the top that they're all Alf from Neighbours or Alf from...
I know, but I don't think that any Alf of them, from Home and Away, Bruce the Judge, were even that big in the story. Like, Jug McKenzie... is pretty much the same character as Bruce. Like, really? Like, they're just different variations on adjusting the volume level on how ochre they are, you know?
Yeah, it's gone from 10 to 11.
Like, yeah, it's like...
I get that if you were reading this as an American, it wouldn't be as big a deal. No, yeah. Nowhere near.
I thought it was interesting that we were Australians actually doing it. Like, I thought was,
yeah, but as an Australian, it's so obvious to me.
Yeah.
It kind of stands out like a sore... Like, it just...
And I'm sure, like, an Irish person reading, like, Judge Joyce, when Ennis wrote him, like, had the same complaints. Ennis was Irish. Wagner and Grant were British. And, I mean, British have a pretty good grasp on the Australian.
You know, look, if they'd done it with a single character, or one or two characters that were like that, and the rest were moderated, I don't care what ethnicity the author is. It doesn't make a difference to me. I think you're able to write an Australian or Irish or Scottish, whatever character... I think if you're going to really push stereotypes and push that borderline racist at times character, you kind of need to do it very cleverly.
But I thought it was for laughs more than anything, man. I didn't see a lot of, like, there wasn't a lot.
If it was for laughs, it would have been once or twice.
Yeah, I don't know. If I
keep doing the same joke over and over, it doesn't get funnier.
No, and I don't think...
It kind of goes through that lull of... All right, we've heard it already. Let's move on and get a different gag. Yeah,
there's a reason, like, Jerry Seinfeld's act sort of, like, you know, stagnates after a while.
But everybody, unless you kind of modify it, you can't do the same thing over and over again. You kind of...
Yeah, and the sheer length of this title meant that I think that the Australian guest spots were very small, but the sheer length of the title meant that a few of them added up. Like, you make a decent point. Like... And I thought that was actually, to be honest, that's one of the reasons I even picked this, because I thought that even made it more interesting that as Australians we're reading the British kind of slightly taking the piss out of us, but through a lens of an American, you know, I've always found it fascinating that the British did a satire on Judge Dredd, the Americans kind of took seriously, and then they kind of adjusted it. You know?
Yeah, look, if you want to see an Australian satire done well, ironically, you actually go to The Simpsons.
Do you?
And their Australian episode they did probably around season 8, 7, something like that.
Right.
Is actually incredibly well done and hilarious.
Okay. All right.
Where you've kind of got a couple of the characters who are so over the top and the rest just have an accent. It's not...
Yeah, okay.
But it's really cleverly done, and it's from a show like The Simpsons, where you're not expecting a high bar of satirical comedy.
I mean, I didn't see... That being a huge part of this comic, to be honest. I thought
it's probably not. It's not a massive part. It's just so noticeable to me as an Australian.
That's fair. And that's part of the reason I even picked it. Like, other than... I mean, I know what I'm setting myself up for with Judge Dredd with you. So I deliberately try to...
Look, I mean, I sit down to read these things from cover to cover. Yeah. Like, I'm not skimping out on reading it or skimming it or whatever else.
To pick this stuff up means you've read it and picked up some nuance, you know?
Like, I'm viewing it through my own kind of lens and my...
What did you
the rhetoric that I've kind of got and the discord that I'm bringing.
What did you think of the Judder stuff? Because to me, that was kind of just normal, classic action dread. Those Judder issues.
That, for me, made more sense. Yeah. I actually kind of preferred that, even though it's the less popular
overall.
I think that was the more palatable of the stories.
Well, that's more traditional dread. Like, I think at the time, they were sort of like, they gave half a year to Chopper. And they're like, at the time, they didn't have the magazine. So at the time, the only way to get new Dredd was through 2000 AD.
Yeah.
They launched that magazine a couple of years later. So I think there was probably a concern that not everyone would buy into just 26 episodes of Chopper, so we need to put some Dredd action in. I didn't mind it, but at the time, it felt like, oh, man, Judder. But then I was like, I don't kind of mind this Judder. And that became a huge storyline in later years. Look, I mean, I actually think Stuart, like, has made some excellent points. And it was really one of the reasons I purposely picked this, but we've touched on so many of the reasons. I
don't know whether it was just that Judder was what I was expecting from Judge Dredd.
Well,
I mean, that's the kind of beats that I was expecting before picking
up. That's the majority of Dredd, and that's the majority of, like, Wagner and Grant's Dredd and stuff like that.
And so I found that better, but I still found it slow.
I liked the art, though. The art in the Judder stuff with McCarthy. I love Brendan McCarthy's art there. It's kind of that wild, almost surreal, you know, take he does.
The art looks great.
Yeah, I dug it.
And the version I was reading had... Every now and again, we had, like, a colour few pages I was reading. I had, like, the coloured edition or whatever it was.
In those days, in 2000, the centre issues of the comic were in colour.
Yeah.
And gradually, as I was reading...
So that's what I was reading. Yeah. I wasn't reading an entirely black and white one. No. And
cool.
The artwork was great the whole way through. I think this is Black and White Comics done really well.
Yeah, definitely. We'll take a rest from Dread. This was a big reader. I really want to listen to what listeners thought of it. I know Adam has picked up like a best of Judge Dread hardcover recently that he's been reading, and he's going to report back to me on that. And I mean, they can be tough, Stu, because like I'll take you back to like issue one of Dread, and to be honest, issue one of Dread is pretty raw and pretty primitive. You know what I mean?
I think you're going to find that with almost every title.
Yes.
Like, unless the title starts in, say, the 80s or something.
Yeah.
Like, when we read The Cloak and Dagger, issue one was a brilliant first issue.
It was good, yeah.
If you're going back to, like, the 60s...
Well, it's late 70s, but, like, 2018 was, like, the second issue. You know what I mean? Like,
it's tough. It's tough reading early on. It often takes a few years for the writers to kind of find their feet. And
it did there, too.
What works with the character. And that's common to pretty much everything, every medium, really.
Exactly. But, like, overall, I'd give this a 9 out of 10. What would you give this, Shu?
I only have a 3. I think the artwork's the only thing that saved it.
Yes, Shu was...
Story-wise, this wasn't good.
Well, we take the hit. What does that make the average, Shu, for it? Does it make
9 and 3? It's 6.
Okay. Well, you know, it is what it is. I will say this, though. If you're interested in Judge Dredd, it's definitely one to pick up. It is a little bloated and a little overlong. I say that kind of objectively, even as a Judge Dredd fan, but like if you like Chopper, this is the story to read. There's one really good Chopper story after this, and then pretty much nothing else. There's kind of, he does one more Super Surf, which is extremely violent and good, and quite a deep story. But this was kind of a cresting moment for 2000D in the title. Now, Stu, what are we doing next show? I know you had a pick. I forget what it was.
Next show, you were running solo.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I'm going to do a shorter show. There is a Jimmy that I'm potentially doing.
Unfortunately, I'm out of town and there's no way we can schedule a...
That's a shame.
...a joint time to record a podcast next week. Well, so
next week I'll do a shorter, sort of more news-focused show. I'll probably pick a couple of weeklies. I deliberately will not do Detective. I'll wait for Stu to come back to do that one. So Stu and I will fully break down Detective.
I mean, look, it comes out this week, so pick it up.
Pick it up, read it, enjoy it, you know.
Read it. We've got a shorter show from Dave next week.
Yeah, definitely.
Solo show from Dave.
And I've got a Jimmy's Jargon that I'm going to be doing either this weekend or next weekend. So there's Jimmy's Jargon episode with Jimmy Terz is coming very shortly.
Yep. And then the week after, I'm back for, it'll be 108. 108. And we'll be doing Swamp Thing.
Oh, that's right, Swamp Thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Alan Moore's.
Alan Moore's Swamp Thing.
So volume one of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. So I would suggest to readers and listeners, probably start reading that now.
Yeah, I think if you want to read the whole thing, it is more than 200.
Okay.
Oh,
breaking your own rules, sure. How we ever...
No, I'm picking the first 6. That's what I'd always do.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Comes in at like 100.
Such a stickler for the pages. Rules, aren't you? Like, oh my God, like... I mean, honestly...
Who complains more? You? Yeah. You...
Do I complain? Are you kidding?
Are you complaining right now?
Yeah.
Is that what you're doing?
I do complain a fair bit. But I don't know what the point of this was. But so the first 6 issues, yes? Is that right?
Yeah, look, if you enjoy it, read more. We always do.
I mean, it's considered... I've never read it. I've actually been saving it for the show. So this will be first time reading for me.
Yeah, and see, I'm one issue in and...
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll...
Well,
basically, we're both reading it for the first time. We'll give it a review in 2 weeks.
I mean, it's considered one of the high watermarks of like modern comics, really. Swamp Thing. It's Alan Moore's like how he basically became Alan Moore on the American market.
Yeah,
he
massive landmark issues.
Fantastic. Well, listeners, don't despair. Despite Stu's like outrageous negativity, I will do more Dread for the show, but we'll just have to wait for it to cool down for a little bit. This didn't cost me a captain's call, which...
No, it didn't. It probably should have done now that I look back on it, but...
I think I got Stu just in a... You were just in a weak moment, man. You just kind of... I was fully prepared to cash in a captain's call. I mean, we all know what my captain's calls are going to be, Conan Punisher, so got to be...
Have they ever done a crossover of Conan and Punisher?
They should. They should do one immediately.
And have they, though? Have they never...
I don't think so. Well, they're going to do one. They're doing one soon in Savage Avengers. It's going to have Conan and Punisher in it.
God, that sounds terrible.
They've done Conan and Wolverine, like, what happens if Conan was in the 20th century, and they've done, like, what happens if Wolverine battled Conan, like, in What If comics. But I don't think they've ever...
What if I get... Like, I get that. Throw any two characters together, what if, fine.
But Savage Avengers, also written by Jerry Duggan, that will be... What was it? Ghost Rider, Punisher, fucking Brother Voodoo, who we don't need.
Venom. Conan and Venom, yeah. Like, I mean, I know you're just pumped up for that one, Stu.
I mean, everybody loves a bit of Brother Voodoo, don't they? Let's go Brother Voodoo.
Brother Voodoo's on, everyone's like, and who's that? And you're like, not 100% sure.
I enjoy Ghost Rider. I have enjoyed Venom at times, but...
Yeah, and Robbie Reyes is the Ghost Rider who'll be appearing in that one too, I believe. Yeah,
I'm very happy with that.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. Any other comments, thoughts, Stu? Any other... You mean, if you want to, like, you know... Back down now on the Hugh Jackman property portfolio stuff. I'll give you the easy out now if you just want to tap out on that argument. How close are we getting Hugh? Are we getting closer and closer to getting
Hugh? Can people start writing in and telling Dave to shut up? Just start writing in and telling him to shut up. Just, hi, Dave. Love the show. Shut up.
All right.
Love from me.
That's, on that note...
Start posting that on Facebook, people. Get on Facebook. Get on Twitter. Start...
I think twice.
Stuck and involved.
I handle all the Facebook and all the media.
I know, so you don't even need to address it today. just right in there.
There's no need. Like, we have an open forum. Hugh, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on. I won't haul you over the coals too much, but I would like some balance sheets or something. Maybe, just bring some financial proof of your status just so we can throw it in his face. You know, let's get the valuation on the coffee empire. It's got to be 50, 60 million at this point. You know.
And you're better off going through Ryan Reynolds. At this point, you're better off going through Ryan Reynolds. If you want the lowdown on Jackman, that's who you got to go.
He is a big fan.
Yeah, that's who you got to go. On that note,
Kimberly
Furness. Go,
good night, kids. Go after Ryan.
See ya.